Hey, it's Rob. It was an amazing week of Survivor, and we had incredible podcasts with Christian Hubicki and Steven on the Know-It-Alls. Make sure you catch those as well. Plus, The Circle was back this week with an AI contestant. Taryn, Mike Bloom, and Puya broke down the first week of drops from The Circle and on Renap. Who did Sam Moore find for the big guest? Find out on this week's Rob and Akiva Need a Podcast, all right here on RHAP. We know reality TV.
Hello, everyone. Shannon Gates here, getting you ready for the Australian Survivor Week 3 Wrap Up Podcast. Thank you so much for clicking on this and checking it out. So just to let you know, the show notes at the beginning of the episode, we have our recap with Mike Bloom. We got into absolutely everything, that I can assure you. Then we have our ex interviews. We have ET around the 2-hour, 6-minute mark. We have then Sam at the 2-hour, 17-minute mark. And then we have Sarah at the 2-hour, 27-minute mark. So all three ex interviews, obviously a big recap. Just a personal note from me, I'll actually be appearing on ABCRN. So that's Radio National's Stop Everything, you know, arts and pop culture podcast and radio show. So that's Sydney time around 10 a.m. this Friday, August 9th. I think I'll be coming in about, you know, 30 minutes into it, so maybe about 10:30. But the show starts at 10 a.m. If any of you guys want to listen live, I'm going to be talking about the podcast and this crazy podcast community and Survivor in general. So you can listen to that on your local RN frequency. Just look up online, you know, where that pertains to you if you live in Australia. I'm also on radio.abc.net.au or the ABC Listen app. And then after that, it gets made into a podcast. You can listen to that on Stop Everything's Apple Podcast channel, or again, the ABC Listen app, or under Stop Everything on the ABC website. So I hope you guys will check that out. Thank you so much for checking this podcast out. I hope you enjoy and see you on the other side. Hello, everyone, and welcome to RHAP's coverage of Australian Survivor. I'm your host, Shannon Gates, here to talk about week 3. That is episode 6 to 8. We are so far through this season, and it's literally been 2 weeks since the premiere. That's a lot of Survivor in a very short amount of time. But to talk about another great, crazy, wild week of the show, I have brought in an absolute expert in everything Survivor, international Survivor. He's my Survivor SA co-host. He's the co-owner of the Survivor B&B. Please welcome Parade Magazine's Mike Bloom. Mike, thank you very much for being here.
I'm surprised, Shannon. You know, we've spent 12 going on 13 weeks together talking about Survivor South Africa. I was waiting for you to call me the Mexican Parmy to your John.
Yeah, good question. I introduced you in a normal way because the Australian Survivor podcast is where I try to be a normal person as opposed to the...
That's not going to happen with me on this podcast, just so we're all aware about that. I also loved how, you know, you pumped up this big mystery guest, and having me on is like the equivalent of the butler did it in a mystery of like, oh yeah, I guess that makes sense. It would be Mike Bloom. It's a Survivor podcast. He's basically... holds it over people's heads that he has to appear on a Survivor podcast at this point, apparently.
I think it would have been a good bet. Like, if you were going to put money on who my mystery guest would be, you were a good bet, and you're here, and I think everyone's really excited about it.
I hope so, because I'm very excited to talk about this season. CVC2 is blowing CVC Prime out of the water right now, in my opinion, and it has not stopped this week, considering all of the, I'll just say, questionable moves that have been going on. That's translated directly from SA over to Australia. I'm glad that's been the theme of International Survivor this year.
Yeah, this is like the perfect combination of seasons. It's like they got their champions and contenders, which they need for like commercial reasons, but it's still so much fun. I think from a super fan perspective, you know, all of the moves and the power shifts and some of the really great characters, it's like we can have an amazing season, amazing pre-merge, and it can still, I mean, don't do it every time. Maybe don't ever do it again, but champions and contenders 2.0 is actually working out.
Yeah, and what I would say is, you know, I actually feel like the first 5 episodes of last season were excellent as well. I remember shouting CVC's, you know, praises to the high heavens last time when we had, you know, Matt and Russell self-destruct, and then you had, you know, Damien was going with sort of like a mercy kill, but you had the whole thing of, you know, Steve getting flipped on. I honestly feel like once Moana left, considering how pivotal of a character she was, that's when the pre-merge went a little downhill and went a bit into the drudges, like you were saying. But so far, I mean, it has been firing on all cylinders. I don't know if that would have been the case if we hadn't had the champions go to tribal council so much, because I will say all my love to, you know, those famous athletes who put themselves on the line over the course of their careers for this notoriety in the name of the game. But it's kind of nice to lose some of those people who don't have the most sterling personalities. And as a result, you know, we were left with that bottom group that are all fantastic personalities in their own right that have become the top. And it's a very similar story this week as well.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously we have the champions that we all really like. And now this week we're seeing the contenders that I think we've been able to invest in, the Davies, the Johns, the Badens, and they're the ones who are kind of leading it strategically. Certainly Andy's in the mix as well as a character. And I think that now I'm looking at it and I'm like, of the people I've been allowed to get to know, not everyone gets confessionals, but of most of these characters, I really enjoy a lot of them, which is high praise for a season with 24 people.
Yeah, and we didn't realize, you know, there are so many nicknames going around. We have Roscoe, we have Maddie, we have Cassie. Everyone's just so, collegiate with each other.
This is unfair because I'm going to get Casey/Cassie's name wrong on the podcast. Like, to not even show us to really anything about her and then only to get her name wrong, it's like, now I'm going to be confused and then I'm going to get something wrong and then I'm going to feel bad.
Yeah, this was an interesting week for Casey. You know, Cassie. I'm sure Sam is going to, we're definitely have, you know, a kettle of fish to talk about with Sam. Simon is still just sort of out there hanging out, the official mute of the show so far. But I feel like this has been a big coming out party for Casey between, you know, what happened on those planks of the immunity challenge, the secret scene that was in that episode as well, to her trying to scramble from the bottom. I guess swaps sort of bring that out in people depending on the position that they're in, and as a result Casey got more story prominence. We're going to talk a lot about story over the course of this podcast, I have a feeling.
Yeah, well, I did put out a Twitter poll after episode 6 asking which of the four people with zero confessionals, much like Benji last season, was going to become our new Benji, and I think that Casey/Cassie is a good bet. I mean, spoiler alert, it won't be Sam, unfortunately. So that just limits it now to just the three of them. And I think she is the one kind of leading it. Hannah still doesn't have a confessional, which now doesn't make you immune from going home. It's a cruel world out there in Survivor.
Yeah, but who has the most likely chance to just randomly show up with a black eye during one episode with no explanation?
I feel like David. Like, I know he's not in that group, but like, David is crazy and David is the one who would show up with a black eye.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, there's certain people on social media that want to give him a black eye, so I guess that makes sense.
Yes, okay, well, that is a great way to kind of get into the meat of these episodes, because let's talk about that, you know, episode 6 a little bit first until we get into, like, the big swap, which was obviously, like, the focal point of this week. But David here is an option to go home, and social media, I feel, definitely maybe with the casuals, was kind of screaming for the blind side. I think that we kind of naturally want a more exciting end result for the episode. Maybe David was pissing a little bit of people off, and people thought it was the right move, maybe for the girls to flip on them. So what did you think strategically for the girls that they should have done here?
First, let me just say, I have fallen head over heels over leather jacket in love with David.
Oh, me too.
He might be the best Survivor villain in quite some time, just because when you have people like your Natalie Whites and your Angelinas, they can do things that might be perceived as villainous, but I don't think they intend to do it. I firmly believe that David knows he's a heel and he's playing that up. You know, there's so many weird characterizations that he does in the myriad confessionals that he received this week in particular. I actually believe Jonathan Gray, who's been doing a great job of sending us confessional accounts after every episode, I believe he has now passed Luke as the number one confessional giver right now, which is like, he's beating Luke at his own game, which is absolutely bananas. But it's just so interesting to see him almost, you know, purposely tent his fingers and say excellent in all his machinations. That being said, does it reflect well on his game? Maybe not, considering that he literally said at Tribal Council, do what you're told, which could very easily have sent other people home. When it comes to the strategic acumen of the move, I do not think they should have done this. I don't know if they were anticipating an impending swap, but if they were, they knew that they had David on their side. Why risk alienating Luke and possibly trying to bring in, you know, Simon and ET, even though they still know that they're on the outs, instead of just going in united? Yes, Simon's a bit of a straggler, but you still have this really strong six that is going to stick together. Not to mention you have people like Abby and Ross who have already flipped considering how emotionally charged they are and how much they, especially Abby, sort of got castigated for flipping the first time, I don't know if she's want to flip back once more and to gain a certain reputation. So I really do feel like from their perspective in the game, even if it didn't make great TV, I think it was the most sound move they could have made.
Yeah. Okay. So I love David. I mean, he makes Luke look normal. A lot of these people make Luke look normal. Luke is like the fourth craziest person on the show at the moment, which is in itself insane. So I'm so happy that David is still on my TV. Strategically, I totally agree with you. Like, David is not as sneaky as he thinks, and these girls, the three of them, I love that group of three. Such a smart group of women. And you know what? Who is playing who? Because they kind of have the jump on David. You know, Janine knows about his idol. Pia knows about what he's been saying to the contenders. And even when he kind of casually throws out Pia's name, it's to Abby. So they completely have him on lock. They very, very smartly will not make this move without at least Luke, if not Luke and Ross, which I think is brilliant. I mean, before a possible swap or just going forward, do you want to completely cut up this alliance and alienate other people who won't work with you? Of course not. So they want to keep it cohesive. David has an idol he might be able to use for them, you know, at a swap or something. And I think the girls can handle him. You know, they know what his MO is and they'll be able to handle him down the track of the season. So I totally agree with you that while people were screaming for it in the TV moment, I don't think this would have been the right thing strategically for them. And also as a TV moment, I would have been disappointed. Yes, you would have had one more blindside than like a down the middle vote, but you would have lost David, who is becoming, you know, Luke is Luke, but one of the better characters of the season. And I don't think every episode needs to be a huge blindside. And it's different with three episodes a week. I know US Survivor feels like every vote needs to be shocking. We talk about this on the Survivor Side podcast. Yeah.
But like, basically, it's like you're having a meal once in a while as opposed to like three square meals a day where you can say, oh, yeah, you know, breakfast wasn't so great, but lunch and dinner were pretty good. Instead, you're like, the one lunch I had this week was poor and now I'm starving and I just need sustenance. You know, I think that's sort of the advantage that Survivor Australia has in terms of just the pure amount of content it puts out. Shannon, I can't believe we're already a third of the way through the season.
Yeah, I'm literally dying. But anyway, no, but like, I like that they've been down the middle votes because it gives weight to the flips. And I was actually talking about this with my brother last night. And it's like, do you really care if people flip on something that was made 2 days ago? You're not invested in that. But the two major flips we've seen in this season, I think have been two of the more exhilarating flips ever because it's been against the Sporty Seven, which was so well established and like such a huge thing that we understood why that was a big thing to take down. And then the flip at the swap that we'll talk about is flipping on the champions versus that contenders dichotomy, which is obviously the central argument of the season. So I would rather have a blindside here. I would rather actually that there are some episodes where it's a little bit down the middle because then the blindsides have that much more weight to them. The show is easier to follow. You understand these big groups. So when they shift, you're like, wow, that was amazing. And it's so true in Survivor history. Like, think about the biggest votes, you know, like in Heroes versus Villains. It was because it was the heroes and the villains coming, against each other. And then when you think about, like, in Marquesas, when they flipped at the final nine, because it was such a huge thing, you know, obviously it'd been built up the whole season and they took down the Road to Four. So that's, I really enjoy that. And I don't think, it's something that has crystallized for me in watching International and especially watching the season of Australian Survivor. It's like, when you have a couple of boring votes, or boring, and of course there's still intrigue throughout the episode, which is so important, and the fake idol has been such a big part of that. But when, you know, it's not always backed up a tribal council with a big blindside, when you get that blindside a couple of episodes later, it will affect you very much.
Can we, I mean, we're also going to, if we lose David, we're deprived of his amazing fashion choices. Can we do a quick ding, marry, kill, Shannon, with some of David's key clothing items here?
Okay,
because I count, I have the leather jacket. I have the weird, like, Aerosmith-esque scarf thing that he wears. And I have his newest addition, which is Nova's denim cutoff shirt.
Mm. I love the cutoff shirt because that's his matching outfit with Luke.
Yeah, so now he's twinning with Luke. So now I think that you really cannot deny that you have an alliance with somebody if you were deliberately matching your clothes.
Yeah. Pretty obvious power duo. So I would marry that, obviously, because they're, like, married by idol. More Survivor South Africa reference for you there. The scarf, I feel like ding that because it's just, that's the weird one. That's the one I want to see what that's about. And then
that's a freaky outfit, David.
It is, but I mean, like, you got to kill the leather jacket because, look, what crazy person would come onto the show wearing a leather jacket, but yet it's, like, the 100th craziest thing David has done in the last few days, so I get it.
Yeah, and listen, something had to die to create that leather jacket, so he should die as well for it.
Yeah, definitely even more so kill it then. But let's talk more about what I have in my notes here is David's lies. David and his fake idol continues to be, like, just an incredible story thread for the season. The fact it's, like, going on 2 weeks. It's entertaining pretty much every episode. It has really paid off dividends, and it's going to get even worse and blow up. So I'm extremely excited. But basically, his increasingly complex story. I want to chart what David told Sean, who, by the way, he was, like, so antsy about him coming to the Champions Beach for that, you know, one reward. It was like, well, what are you going to do with a swap? If you're so antsy about that, maybe you shouldn't have done the move. But anyway, it is what it is.
And then, oh my God, I will also say when Baden picked Sean, I cackled out loud because I thought of all the possibilities. Of course, neither David nor any of us knew that Sean, apparently, I don't know, maybe he put his idol in his back pocket and washed his shorts a couple times and, like, a dollar bill, didn't realize it was in there until he took it out of the laundry. But it took, what, like 10 days from what we're seeing on the next time on for Sean to realize that his idol's finally a fake?
Yeah, that is crazy. I don't know why he didn't just look at the idol. I mean, in the time that it took him to get the idol and look at it, his main ally formed a crucial alliance with David to turn on her former tribe. It's actually poetic. But so David tells Sean, this is a story. Imagine if this would be somehow an even better season than what we've currently been watching, which is a high bar. So apparently Nova found the idol, got voted out by Steve, but before she did, and without playing the idol, gave it to David. So in that world, she's getting voted out, but she's given her, so, okay, didn't use it to save herself, but it is what it is. And then he idled out Steve and saved Pia. And, like, I mean, look, this is entertaining. It kind of reminds me of, like, Russell's story to JT in Heroes versus Villains of why Parvati didn't get idled out with JT's idol. And it was like, he, like, manifested the No Vote tribal, like, years in advance, where it was like, you know, Parvati, he played his idol, but Parvati played his idol. So they voted out Courtney. And it was like, wow, that's the best tribal council of all time. So if they're believing that, that's what you created. And that's what David made about this first week of the show.
David really is, you know, the best at creating Survivor fan fiction. He's creating the Survivor blues brand steel. With the his model tendencies out there with this cockamamie vote, I feel like there should be, like, a segment every week called David, why'd you do that? And this is the one. This is the one this week that I'd say, David, why did you do that? There's no reason for you to be like, oh yeah, you know, I already lost this idol, so you know what? I guess he wanted to appear powerless in front of Sean so he doesn't feel like, you know, someone would have to approach him later and say, hey, you have an idol, use it on me. But at the same time, it's such a heavily complicated thing where the idol apparently changed hands like 3 times over the course of a 2-round period, according to him, that it just sounds infinitely complicated. And now I can understand why David looks at the game the way he does, is because he's essentially trying to manufacture this type of chaos that he's brewing up in his own scenarios.
Yeah, am I wrong for, like, judging Sean harshly for just being like, wow, what an amazing story? Like, we didn't really get the confessional from him, but he seemed to obviously really believe it and vibe with David and just be like, that sounds like a crazy first week of the game. Well, lucky it all worked out.
Shannon, I think David is officially the horse whisperer.
That was brilliant.
That is it. Is that like if you're Sean, are you offended when you're called a horse by literally everyone in the game?
I mean, I kind of get it. I know we have a football coach here whose nickname is Horse. I hadn't heard it for Sean Hampson, obviously, before this, but maybe it's a I've realized through Australian Survivor that I know so little about Australian culture. And then I realized through South African Survivor that I know so little about South African culture. So I'm like, who am I? Genuinely,
wow.
Crisis of faith for me. But the thing with David is clearly what he was trying to do with, like, the Nova story was he was trying to be like, look, if you find out it's a fake, Nova gave it to me, like, you know, then he could have some plausible deniability, like, about Nova giving it to him and maybe it was her fault. And then with the Pia vote, he's trying to say, I don't have an idol, so I'm not threatening. Like, I understand that. The issue is that it's extremely easy to verify that this isn't true. And he can't even go back to his allies and ask them to lie to him because none of them know except Janine that he has the idol. So, like, when they ask Pia later at the challenge, he could have, you know, asked her to verify because she doesn't know anything that's going on with all these fake idol shenanigans. So every part of it is verifiable that it wasn't true. Like, Pia didn't have an idol played on her, and Steve didn't vote out Nova, and Nova and David were enemies in the game. Like, it's so easy to prove as false. So I understand what he was trying to do, but he really dug the hole so much deeper for himself.
Yeah, I gasped, actually, when they were on the planks, and Casey was able to, I don't know whether Cassie, whether or not to purposely or not, she was able to worm some information out of Pia and Simon. But I was very intrigued as to why either we didn't get shown or whether they actually didn't do this. Why Simon and Pia, particularly Simon, who's on the bottom, doesn't use that information against David. Maybe they thought the contenders were lying to them to rile them up. But that just feels like a nugget of gold that dropped in your lap. Don't throw it back into the river.
Look, maybe we didn't see it, but look, in the finale podcast last season, and it pains me to say this because I love Simon Black, I love him as a footy champion, but remember we talked about how Commando Steve could have been replaced with a cardboard cutout? Cardboard cutouts, you know, can't go and cause havoc like that. So unfortunately, Simon Black had to just kind of watch his main ally go home.
See, yeah, and I am very glad you pointed that out, because I had just sort of made a declaration. I think it was last week when we were, again, looking at those confessional charts. I said, I think that Simon has commando upside here. I think we are getting the like stoic sportsman who's going to make it like halfway through the jury phase and then end up just voting very bitterly on like honor and loyalty. I have nothing else to go on at this point. So
he seems less bitter than Simon. He seems like a more soft, like genteel man, but I definitely think in terms of strategic capabilities, he unfortunately, I think, is becoming our cutout commando.
Yeah. So I mean, what are your thoughts about it? I mean, if you are someone like Pia, where David is in your alliance, I mean, is that just something you pocket? I mean, again, we talk about Survivor South Africa, where literally nobody can keep a piece of information private. But is that something you sort of keep in reserve for later? Or do you use that to try to blow up your alliance in that moment?
I really wonder what is being shared between those three girls. I would assume everything. Like, I know we didn't see it, but I assume Pia kind of went back to them. I assume that Janine has kind of told them about the idol, and maybe it's totally wrong to assume that. But look, if you're hearing that about David, if you're hearing about anyone else, you'd be like, that's worrying. But when you hear it about David, you're like, yep, that crazy man is up to something, like he always is, and we're like five steps ahead of him, so it's really fine, you know? So like, she could have blown it up, but as we've said, there are a million reasons why that would have been wrong for a game, why it would have been too soon, why you don't want to flip-flop. Like, you might want to flip in the first week, but you don't want to flip-flop, you know? So as we've said, it would have been the wrong move. So I don't doubt that she might have told her closest allies about it, but I don't know what she could have really done with that other than flip her entire game based on it, which we've kind of agreed is not the right thing.
Right. Let me also just say, I'm loving my Aussie dream girls of Abby, Janine, and Pia. They're a fantastic group. But on that note, I mean, it's actually very similar parallels to what we see in both episodes 6 and 8, where there's a choice essentially between, and I don't want to paint E.T. in a bad light here, but it's the devil you know versus the devil you don't. In both cases here, they choose someone who is admittedly more duplicitous than the other person, but they're so transparently duplicitous that, like, you know what they're going to do. And as a result, it's like David says about Andy, you know, they're a snake, but they're almost defanged in that regard. Granted, I think David has a bit more venom to him since he has an idol in pocket, but because he is just so out there with every single move he makes, good or bad, he's a lot easier to track than somebody like Sarah, who we'll talk about later on, who has the ability to really sneak her way in anywhere without anybody noticing.
Yeah, and especially for Pia. I mean, I loved my ex-interview with E.T. He seems like a really lovely person, and, you know, he probably was working well, especially with someone like an Abby. But for someone like Pia, she's the name that's been thrown out by E.T., I think, quite a few times just for being the weakest. So David's someone that she vibes with and connects with on a strategic and emotional level. If she's going to be using this information to save E.T., like, he's doesn't really value her in the game just physically. He wasn't the ally for her. And, yeah, unfortunately with David, like, there's no half measures. What are you going to half blow up his game? You know, you're going to have to then blow it up and vote him out, which is not what they wanted to do, and we don't begrudge them that.
While we're on the episode 6, I just want to talk about that challenge, that immunity challenge, because it was so interesting. And one thing we're going to talk a lot about, I'm assuming, Survivor, Australian Survivor editing. And I will say, one of the things that I really do enjoy that they do is not only the challenge stuff, but a lot of crosstalk at challenge stuff, whether it's, you know, Maddie bragging to the other tribe for the umpteen time or the conversations that are going on those perches. I mean, this is a big three episodes for Baden. And he started off super strong here with not only getting picked for the burgers, but calming down Cassie at the ledge
Casey,
and then just
nope.
And then just getting cut off mid-sentence as he drops into the ocean.
Yeah, I knew it was coming and it was still so amazing. Like, I loved the editing of that challenge. I love that whole thing, like how they were too far away to kind of know what was going on, how their backs were to them. That was just so entertaining to me. I actually loved a lot of the challenges this week. I enjoyed the simple kind of desperate frustration of a tug of war. I loved them being on the perch. Episode 8, both challenges, they were just kind of trying to drown them, which is, I guess, a weird thing, but I thought, you know, pretty compelling.
All right, let's like rub their hands raw, give them a bit of a rest, and then try to waterboard them.
Well, not a rest. I mean, that episode 7, like, I feel like I put my back out watching it in that, like, balancing challenge.
Well, it's just like when you exercise, you're exercising different body parts, but in this case, in Survivor, it's pushing them to their breaking point. I just can't believe that in episode 6 they had two challenges in a row that involved holding onto a rope and essentially tested grip strength. Like, the poor horse's hooves are going to need a new shoeing after this, just because of, you know, how much was going on. But it is interesting as well that, you know, they temporarily went back to like these pure endurance challenges, because I feel like one of the reasons why the contenders, even though they lost a lot of reward challenges, which were really based on brute strength, they were able to win a lot of these immunity challenges because there were multiple components to them, mostly throwing at the end so that Andy could come in and save the day. But these ones were, I mean, I know we say that Australian Survivor is really based in physicality in its challenges, and that is not an understatement this week. Except for episode 8, we could definitely talk about the river swim, but it's so interesting to turn Last Gasp, arguably the most frightening Survivor challenge ever, with your head underneath the grate, turning that into a team immunity challenge is such an interesting twist.
Yeah, I love that. And I also thought, you know, they were saying that they thought that the people in the actual, you know, chambers didn't really matter. It was more about how many people, you know, the runners were the most important part to fill it up quickly. But I actually think those people mattered more than they had anticipated. I mean, if you could hold your breath, you could buy people a lot of minutes. So I think that might have been kind of the wrong strategizing there on the challenge, and kind of putting in your best people in the chamber, because kind of anyone can run and fill up a bucket, surely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or, you know, don't put someone in there who has traumatic experiences with rushing water filling up around them.
Yeah, did she have to do the swim upstream as well? Because it's like her horrible,
no.
horrible. I mean, not that we saw, but we know there are so many matchups that we miss. And like her story, which is just beyond, you know, she was scared of jumping into water, being dragged by water, like literally it's every component of the story, which is horrific.
Yeah, one of the more dickish things that David said, not even like playfully dickish, just dickish moments. He was the dickhead this week, where he said, like, hey, you know what? She told us she can't do things. And in Survivor, if you say you can't do things, then you're gone. Dude, she says she can't do things because she like has this painfully horrific incident that has scarred her, you know, even decades after the fact. That's why she wasn't gonna, you know, lie in a water coffin for a second, bro. It was such weird logic. I can understand why they targeted her ultimately, but I do think it does suck that, you know, when the champions were planning, which I feel like now we should use it as an editing trademark, Shannon, whenever we see the champions planning before a challenge, that's not good. Between Janine's, you know, infamous sidewinder strategy of going under the pole, and now Luke and David being, you know, adamant of, okay, we got to make sure all the big blokes are the ones carrying the buckets. You girls just lay still. I feel like it's going to spell doom for them no matter what.
Yeah, I mean, poor Sarah. Look, David is not denying that he is a villain. You know, I think there's a difference that shows like an extreme difference between him and Luke, who are both like kind of arrogant, cocky, funny people, but David's like an actual villain. You see his voting confessionals and he's just basically says something savage. Luke can say his savage, funny voting confessionals too, but then he often like has some that are really earnest and endearing and tug at the heartstrings. So he's like, now Luke is like the soft, humble person in the duo, which is amazing. That just shows the comparison of how cocky David has become. But I want to talk about this duo, certainly the central duo of the show we're watching, because let's get to the swap, spelt with an O. So We need to come up with some new tribe names, which is something we do on the Survivor South Africa podcast to kind of differentiate these tribes from their first and second iterations. Austin Smith on Twitter gave us some really good suggestions. So I like the OG champions to be the Champy Ones, and now the tribe we're kind of watching implode can be the Champy Twos. What do we think about that?
Yes. Yes, because their challenge performances are a big number two, so I think that makes sense.
The Champy Ones weren't much better, but anyway, Champy Ones, it's great.
Yeah, and I also offered the Champy Offs for Champions 1.0.
We also have, for the contenders, I said we should do the contenders, and now we're at the contenders. So I feel like that just writes itself. So when I refer to them, that is what I'm going to be doing.
Yes, absolutely. Speaking of swaps, I mean, this is, you know, random draw. This is now, I think, the third season where we've done this. How did you think, you know, it all shook out? Why does it seem like an Australian Survivor, for some reason, it always ends up being in a situation where, like, two people are stuck on a tribe with everyone else from the opposite tribe? I mean, that's what screwed over our poor AK. That's arguably what screwed over Tegan for the second time last season. Is this just, like, something that happens in Australian Survivor by pure luck?
Yes, we fudge in the numbers. No, I was so having flashbacks to AK. I was like, I can't believe Luke was the perpetrator to swap screw AK, and he's about to get swap screwed. As I, like, that's shit karma on my couch in, well, it wasn't karma because he got out of it, but I was so, so terrified from this horrible position that the two main characters in the show were in. I mean, 2-7. Yes, they both had idols, but they had enough votes to split, so they would both have to use them to get through. Then they, you know, obviously are still well in the minority with no idols. I mean, the fact that they made it out of this, I know we're going to talk about some of the editing. I know people had issues with it, but I love this episode so much. I was, like, literally cheering that I can't believe the game flipped for them twice. They didn't have to use their idols, which is so much more fun for me than if they just gone there and strong-armed them. And honestly, maybe it's a recency. No, it's not. I loved it. It was one of the better pre-merge episodes I've watched in a while.
They have testicular fortitude. That
rhino
is
balls is what we say.
Unmatched. I mean, forget rhino balls. They have whale balls at this point. They're gigantic school bus sized.
Well, let's
whale
not
balls.
Mike, it's unnecessary to read that description.
The balls are on a bus going to school, learning about how to become even bigger and stronger.
I mean, you kindly to be normal on this podcast.
Shannon, you know that's not going to happen. A zebra can't change his stripes. But on the note of these two, so I apologize. I'm going to make a couple of Big Brother comparisons here, Shannon. But there is actually one of the original winners of Big Brother is a man by the name of Dr. Will Kirby. And he and this other guy, Mike Boogie, who also won the show down the line, had this infamous alliance called Chilltown.
Yes, my Big Brother knowledge.
And I really do feel like Luke and David are the Chilltown of Australian Survivor, where we're going to get into Daisy's numerous amount of reasons why she ends up flipping in particular. But a big reason is she says, like, I just want to have fun and hang out with these guys. The really interesting thing about Luke and David to me, it's sort of like what I spoke about before, is that they are so transparently jocular, where they're like, yeah, I'm gonna screw you over, but we're gonna have a good time doing it, that they almost endear themselves from that perspective. I mean, that's what Luke really sort of built a name for himself as, a big old troll in his first season, to the point where, you know, when he gets rid of people like Mark and Sam, they're still sort of like, ah, that's Luke. I mean, Luke votes out ET this episode, and ET says in, like, his exit press, like, oh yeah, I'm loving Luke. Go Luke. Yeah. Luke was great. So it's so interesting how, you know, these are playing they're playing probably the two most devious games, but because they are so, I don't know, entertaining almost to the other castaways, they almost shrug it off. Whereas maybe if someone else had betrayed them, they would take it probably a very different way. I also have a different way of doing the swap that I would steal from a Survivor South Africa season, just because I'm personally, as much as interesting as it was to see this ultimate underdog story come to fruition, I'm a little tired of seeing the random polls. So I'm willing to throw an idea in the think tank if you're willing to open it up temporarily, Shannon.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so Survivor South Africa Season 5 did one of the most interesting iterations of a tribe swap that I have ever seen. So they combine the swap with the touchy subjects challenge, like the burn book challenge, where they
My
say
favorite
like
challenge.
Yeah, like who, you know, who would you trust with your life? Who doesn't deserve to be here, et cetera, et cetera. Everyone is playing individually. So they all stand on a set of risers. And if they get the question right, they'll step down a step. And, you know, they'll keep going. It's about like a seven sets of stairs or so. Once they get to the bottom, they then proceed through this gate. The gate, the door alternates between tribes. So the first person who goes through the gate goes to the, let's say, the blue tribe. The second person will go to the red tribe, et cetera, et cetera. And it'll alternate back and forth until the tribes are evenly split. So basically, you know, I feel like one of the unfortunate things with random draw is that it really does incorporate that big element of luck in Survivor. What I really like about this swap is that it incorporates a lot of skill and strategy, where you might have people, you know, maybe they purposely throw a couple of questions to hold out for a certain position to wait for a certain tribe. Yeah, maybe they'll try to blaze through as quick as possible just to sort of get it over with. I really like this idea for a swap because it mitigates the amount of just random draw involved, which very easily could have seen, you know, had a couple of conversations gone differently, one of these major two characters go home just by luck of the draw. If this had gone a bit differently and they tried something like this, we could have seen even more interesting combinations and at least more evenly matched ones.
Yeah, an Australian Survivor definitely has the time to do it. Look, the luck thing, this being swap screwed, is an unfortunate part of the game. I mean, we've seen it happen to literally, you know, Sandra. Like, it can happen to royalty. When it happened to AK, that was unfortunate. Like, he was pretty much the main character of the preseason, or probably top two or three. And to go in that fashion was heartbreaking. I mean, imagine here, and what it looked like was we were going to lose, you know, David and Luke to being swap screwed. And, I mean, look at the confessionals. They have, like, a quarter of the confessionals of the entire season between them. That would have been brutal. Like, it's so lucky for us that they were able to turn it around. So I think that we really enjoy, me and you, when, you know, they give contestants impetus and strategic impetus to kind of choose their own fate and kind of work around things strategically rather than it just being luck. But look, you know, every iteration pretty much does just do, you know, picking the buff, and it can work out badly. So honestly, thank God David and Luke were able to pull this out. And I know that a lot of people, we're going to talk about the contenders, definitely the contenders, sorry, but they, of course, there's a lot there for Daisy and stuff who did great as well. But you can't ignore what Luke and David were doing here. And they didn't just get lucky that the contenders were willing to implode, because Daisy said, as you said, that she just wants to hang out with Luke and David more than Andy and Sammy. And even, you know, we're going to talk about it, but it seems based on Hannah's voting confessional that she seemed pretty keen to flip if Sarah had been keen, which she unfortunately wasn't. So they had people talking after being basically shut down. Most of these contenders were willing to flip on their, you know, flip on their tribe, to work with them. And that's amazing. I mean, we sit here on our couch. A lot of people have said, oh, wasn't that amazing that they didn't play their idol? Why would Daisy have a reason to lie to them? You know, of course they know that that's legit. We say that with a bird's eye view. You come in there 2-7, sit there, and neither of you play their idol. I've said in this very week that not playing your idol in tricky situations is to me almost as, or equally as impressive often as a huge idol play. I completely think that here. I can't believe the bravery to not play it, the social capital to flip everyone, to now be in control.
The whale balls, Shannon, the whale balls.
Oh my God. My podcast is the only one that has hashtag rhino balls and hashtag whale balls as, I don't know why I'm the host that like inspires this out of people, but I clearly am. But,
well, the balls are in your court. What can we say?
Oh my God. Okay. So
I completely agree that what I've found so interesting about this season so far is it really nails home a basic tenet of Survivor. And you and Josh really spoke about it nicely last week, where it's this eternal struggle of who you want to work with versus who you should work with. Like, that was the main conundrum with Abby and Ross, right? Was like, theoretically they should stick with the Sporty Seven, but they really want to work with Team Fun. They want to work with this really fun group of people, so they flipped over.
Team Fun, here, that was the alliance name. See, you came on too late, Mike.
It came late in, late in the game. But, you know, here you have, and we'll talk about maybe Daisy in particular had reasons that were not necessarily shown as to why she betrayed her contenders. But, you know, you have her and John and Baden just really get on with these two guys and say, you know what, I got tired of these people who I wasn't necessarily keen on back at the contenders camp for, you know, nearly 2 weeks in the game. I'm going to come over here. I think that is where, like, this value of the social game, which is such a hard thing to depict, even in the most immaculately edited season of Survivor, becomes so important. I cannot imagine how much just liking a person affects your desire to work with them. And we see it here. You know, David even admits at one point that they're playing up the downtrodden man shtick. And even though we saw a lot of stonewalling going on, I can imagine that they definitely endeared themselves. And I also wonder, I mean, I know Luke is a veteran of the game at this point. I mean, David sort of brought up this idea of, hey, they haven't been to tribal council in a long time. Do you really think that because they have been to tribal council so much up to this point, it gave them that skill set to wheel and deal to get these people on their side?
I mean, David is a bad and a good player. You know, like, he's been to tribal council and he's wielded that. They've both been part of this huge flip. Luke has obviously played at this point over 60 days like of the game, you know, with his first time as well. So, of course, he's a veteran. I think David's a really good player as well. I mean, Luke's social game is so on point. And I'm realizing this time, in a way I kind of didn't in his first go around, that he wields that persona much more actively than I had realized. And he can get away with saying anything by kind of laughing it off. And he's just, I think people are connecting with him in a really genuine way. Just even seeing in episode 8 how Sarah came to him and you know, told him about what she'd heard with Andy and having him kind of react to that. Like, I just think he's just socially so aware, and his social game is so brilliant. And I also think for the two of them, it's good, and I've always said this, and I truly believe this to be true. If you're going to come in a minority, I usually say it in a merge, but it works in the swap, it's really good to be less than 50% of the majority. And I think that the four contenders on the Champion 2 tribe, this is getting hard, but I think it's working, they're in a worse position being 4-5 than 2-7, because are they going to make that flip if they feel like then they're, you know, outnumbered at a point by the Champion 1s? Probably not. But just having these two people to kind of use as numbers and kind of connect within a new group, I think makes, you know, the contenders much more likely to flip. And I think that that helped them as well.
I mean, that's what really helped people like Chris Doherty and Danny Boatwright win, right? Is it wasn't a two situation, but they got down to the one. And at that point, it's almost like the rest of the tribe either, you know, likes you at a certain point, like what happened with Danny, or they just sort of write you off like, yeah, we'll get rid of them later. We have bigger fish to fry right now. You're almost considered a non-entity. You're almost like a ghost in the game. But as a ghost, you can still haunt everyone and, you know, take corporeal form and cast those votes. Can I say something really quick about Luke? Because I was talking about this with you offline, but I have had a fundamental different view of Luke between seasons based on stuff that's happened in my own life.
Yes, talk about it. I mean, I know you're going to talk about the birth of your child, if that's really true, Mike.
Oh, no, you're on to me. There were just, you know, Rob is a parent, Jessica Lisa is a parent, Akiva is a parent. I just wanted to get along with them, so I made up this child. Asher Bloom, no, I
makes
think if
sense.
I said that sincerely, my wife would murder me. She'd put me on a kebab like Harry if she had heard that I had discounted, you know, the intense labor process she went through as fan fiction. But when I heard Luke was coming on to this season, I was nervous, but almost in a different way than you were, in that I wasn't worried about, you know, how he would do in the game. I was worried about his character. I'm a little bit in a weird territory in that when it comes to returning players, the thing I dislike most about that idea is seeing them do the exact same things. One of my favorite things to see with returning player arts is to have them do something differently. You know, a JT coming into Heroes versus Villains and saying, I'm going to play like a villain this time. Sarah Lucina saying, I'm going to go from a cop to a criminal. I don't want to necessarily see somebody come in and say, oh, I'm going to do the same thing again that you know and love, because then that's predictable. And predictability in Survivor is not a lot of fun, as is indicated by the social media response to the ET vote. So when we saw, you know, Luke pull out the spy shack again, I'm like, I love Luke, but I don't necessarily want to see Luke's greatest hits. But as you mentioned, I had a child born.
Okay.
He is legitimate. He's real. He's 3 months old at this point. And I don't know, there was something about Luke in the Champions Cafe, grammar errors aside, where, you know, I looked on his life and just all the hardships that he and his family have gone through. First, all the power to him for going out shortly after his child was born. I know it's the third time around the block, but I have to imagine that he's still missing the kids heavily at this point, especially at such a pivotal point in that child's upbringing. And I'll admit, as already just being a parent, even in my nation stage, has come with so many difficulties and struggles, and you sit up at night, not to your own volition, but you sit up at night and wonder, you know, how can I keep, you know, smiling and keep a positive attitude if I am so worried about so many things going on with these children, or this child, I should say. Now I'm making up other children.
I knew
but
it.
Honestly, to see Luke approach such a difficult situation. And not to say that, you know, he's not going to love his child any less if, you know, they're on the spectrum or if they have cystic fibrosis. But from a medical perspective, it's significantly more difficult to raise a child that way. But to see him encounter those hardships in life with such, you know, a big smile and positive energy, I'm only assuming if he treats his life the same way he treats the game, which, assuming from the interviews he did with you and Nick, seems to be the case. I don't know. It's weird to say that Luke Tokey has inspired me in my life, but to be quite honest, after sort of reconnecting with his view on parenting, I've approached parenting on my own saying, you know what, you smile through everything because it could always be a lot worse and you're always going to get through that. So it's super weird that this one little nugget of the trickster god Loki was something that I gleaned and became one of the most emotionally connected tenets of my life. But that's sort of the new connection I have with Luke now. And so I really do thank him for sort of the representation that he brings. I know, again, there are a myriad of parents on this season, but his own perspective and the attitude that he brings to parenting in particular has really struck home with me and has given me a better attitude for parenting in general. So thank you, Luke. I don't know if you're listening, but thank you, buddy.
Okay, well, that's beautiful. I mean, when I told you to bring the normal version of yourself, I didn't realize you would get to like the realest part, but I appreciate that because that, I mean, that's beautiful. And I, not a parent, I mean, I could make up a child right now, but I totally get what you mean. And I think that's why he's so lovable, you know, like I talk about this every podcast, people are gonna get sick of it and I'm sure they already are, but like people sometimes criticize him because the internet sucks, but criticize him for going out and leaving his sick baby. And it's like, he's there for his kids, and don't be fooled because he's having a great time and he's great at the game and he's, you know, he belongs out on that island. He's there hoping to make a better life for his children. And he thinks he has a good shot at it. He thinks it could be 50 days for $500,000, maybe more, if Sia could just, you know, get in touch. I've been texting her in our all-Australian WhatsApp group. She's not getting back to me, but he's there for that. And I think that's, I've said, that's why he's such a good character. Because if it was just the shallow fun stuff, it'd be fun as hell, and maybe not as fun on the second time. You're right, you know, maybe there'd be diminishing returns. But with that story and that depth and that growth behind it, it will always be compelling. There are so many layers, and we've watched him for 60 something days on the show, and the layers, there's still so much more to discover.
Yeah, and I think that also, I mean, his life story has also allowed him to connect with so many people as well. I mean, that's, we're gonna get to Harry's big lie. That's one reason why he did that, is because I can only assume he connected with so many of what he calls the senior citizens because of his parenting experience, as opposed to somebody like David, who is a little younger. He's more impetuous.
David's way older than Luke.
Oh, really?
I think he's like 39 and Luke's 39.
What?
Yeah.
What?
He looks
age
great.
Wears well on, age wears well on that man's face. But I mean, he's not exactly living like a sympathetic lifestyle. Like, I don't know how much, you know, how much a Janine can relate to, hey, here's a model living in New York. You know, I think that he sort of lives such a literally distinct lifestyle, even out of the country, that's a little tougher to relate to, whereas Luke sort of has this story going for him, at least tugged at my heartstrings. I can understand why people, you know, especially if it comes to the repetition of seeing someone like him all the time because he gives good sound bites, that it gets a little old. But I just wanted to mention that, how I was very surprised to see how much his story in particular really stuck with me, just given the circumstances that I'm personally going through. It's really interesting and not something I thought would be the case whatsoever.
Well, I love that. And I'm now even happier that Luke didn't get swap screwed here. And, you know, to turn it back to kind of the strategy of that from the contenders' position, because we need to talk about them as well. And Daisy is obviously really leading that. And it's hard for us to analyze, having seen so little of the contender dynamic. We really, you know, we basically got one confessional from Andy that kind of spelled out who was on the bottom, who was in the middle, and who was at the top.
We got the Cliffs notes from Andy.
Yeah, it was like, let me catch you up to speed. Here's, you know, basically all the complex dynamics to put into like a very simple hierarchy for you that I was like rapidly timing up in my notes. I'm like, oh my God, this is everything we have on this tribe. But yeah, so it's hard to analyze from that perspective. What we're kind of hearing in exit press and on Twitter and everything like that is that Sammy had thrown out Daisy's name at the contenders tribe. So I think that changes things a little bit, at least for me.
Yeah, completely agree. I have completely separate opinions on this move from JJ's perspective and based on the TV edit and apparently what happened out there. The TV edit, I abhorred this move because they essentially play like, I even wrote in my notes, Shannon, is Daisy the next Tara? In terms of somebody who, you know, was willing to say, like, I don't want to work with this person anymore, so I'm just going to flip on them and I'll, you know, listen to the consequences later. Because it really did come off as pretty flippant on the show. It really did seem like an emotional response where, from what we were being told, it was that Daisy was pissed off that Andy had shared the idol secret to the rest of the contenders. So she said, I'm going to strike at Andy's right-hand woman, which is Sam. But if you look at what happened behind the scenes, which, you know, we have received some really interesting sort of like in player or like weekly tidbits behind the scenes. I know Harry and Baden have posted every week on the Survivor subreddit. Andy posted a very interesting Tumblr post that I heavily recommend everyone check out after this. It gives him a lot of perspective as to all sort of the weird shenanigans and tomfoolery that he was up to over the course of this episode. But from what we found out, it really seems like the contenders dynamic was Daisy and Sean on one side and Harry and Sam on the other side and everyone else just sort of filling in between. And apparently there was also a thing where like all the contender girls were together except Daisy. So from that perspective, I could totally understand why she would want to do this. This is the shot that she has been wanting to take for 2 weeks at this point. She has everything locked and loaded. She just doesn't have the target pop up in front of her. And now it finally has. She's going to do it. We've seen that time and time again. Survivor New Zealand season one, you know, you had these two people who were on the bottom of their first tribe. They swap over and immediately vote out one of their own tribe members because now they have the numbers advantage. It seems like we sort of have the case here as well. But, you know, we did not get that in the TV edit whatsoever. So I'm very mixed on how I'm supposed to proceed this move.
Yeah, I didn't see it as that combustible, even with all of the external information. I mean, for her part in Sammy's exit interview, you know, coming up after this, and I don't know if she would know, but she didn't think that Davey would have flipped if she hadn't heard what Andy had said about the idol. And we're definitely going to talk about Andy, but I still think it was a little emotional. Because Tribal Council was so soon after the swap. That's a very, very quick way to make that move. And also, you know, with all these other factors of the idol and everything like that. But at the same time, it's like she's made it a champion-led game. I think we were kind of seeing this was going to be a game dominated by the contenders. And now we're looking at it and they're in a really bad spot on kind of both swap tribes. So it might actually kind of change around and be a champion ones game. But that's, you know, could be a bad thing for Daisy, obviously not being a champion. But if she doesn't feel good with the contenders, then she kind of has to switch, you know? And if she doesn't have enough allies, like if you look at it, so all the girls are against her and Andy, she doesn't trust it. Harry's with that. It's like, how many allies does she have? Is it literally just John, Maddie, Sean, and I guess Baden? Because then that's not that many people in the game. She needs new allies, and she's made new allies with David and Luke, who she can hopefully work with down the track. Unfortunately, some of that bond is based on a fake idol lie. That's unfortunate for her, for sure. But you can see how, in her mind, she's creating new bonds to work with in a more fluid game and not just make it all about the contenders, who she apparently wasn't in a great spot with.
Yeah, exactly. And I really do wish we had at least some of that information. I know that we didn't see a lot of the contenders before the swap. It really was shades of Galoo in Survivor Samoa, where just because they were winning so much, we really saw nothing of them. But I would have loved to just see some sort of scene of Daisy feeling like she was on the outside.
Yes.
You know, all we saw, but you know, of Daisy content besides the idol stuff was her making ageist comments at the challenges. Like, just knowing a little bit about why she was an outcast would just fill in a little bit of that story. That's all we need. And I'm sure we'll get into Sam's edit. This might be a bit of a combustible opinion as well. I don't necessarily have a problem with people getting more confessionals than others. It's more so a matter of story for me. And this is a case where I felt like the story we were given was completely different from what the story actually was. And what the story actually was seems super compelling. You know, this is almost like a contender becoming a champion, where she's like, I feel like I was on the outs of my old tribe, so now I'm going to take the reins and dictate my own game. But instead, we get this idol conversation, and then we get David saying, I don't like her face. And that's literally the only reasoning we get from Sam, because we don't hear from Sam about her thoughts on the game either. So it's really tough. I mean, like I said, I was ticked off at Daisy for making this move initially. John, yeah, I was just sort of like, all right, he's a come with guy. Though I will say, I gave more kudos to Baden for this move, because Baden, at least up front, seemed to be, from a TV edit perspective, in the position that Daisy actually was on the Contenders, where, like, we knew he was very clearly on the outs. He was in Andy's cliff notes. So from that perspective, what you basically said about Daisy, I totally attribute to Baden as well. He knew he was on the bottom of his group. Why not change it up, try to achieve a majority within this tribe, and also try to make, you know, cross tribal alliances with people who are pretty powerful and have connections as well.
Yeah, and we'd heard Daisy say that to her, Baden really wasn't at the bottom of the Contender. So obviously that's a bond that he had that he's utilized. If he can get through the swap and make it to emerge, I think he's sitting very, very pretty. And another thing is, okay, I don't know how the numbers are going to shake up at emerge. And also, let's take out the fact that this idol is fake, because we know that basically, like, that's the smoking gun of this relationship. But let's say that they actually can continue this bond. You know, if they do get rid of Luke and David, here, and obviously they're trying to split the votes and get rid of, say, a Luke and then a David next time, they're going to be losing every single challenge. So once those two people are gone, where does Daisy sit? Because it seems like they have four with Sarah, Hannah, Andy, and Sam. My God, did I just forget it was Sam? This is the editor.
Cassie.
Okay, so they have those four, and then Daisy, Baden, and John on the bottom. Like, is she out next at the door after them? So I think, I just did call it emotional, and I guess just because it seemed so quick to me. But at the same time, I feel like, you know what, maybe I take that back, because from a numbers perspective, certainly short term, I think it makes a lot of sense. Long term, I think maybe it works for her. Never a bad idea to take someone out of the game that's throwing your name out. And I also thought very interesting that, at least from what we heard from Abby on the other side, Sean was throwing Harry's name out. And it seems like Harry and Sam are really close, and that Daisy and Sean were really close. So if they're having the same ideas, it must have been based on some pretty clear dynamics. And logistically, numbers-wise, logically, I think it makes a lot of short-term sense and possibly a lot of long-term sense.
The only sticking point I have with this is what we see in episode 8, where Daisy puts herself out really in front as the face of this contender betrayal. You know, like, there was this whole contender strong mentality. We busted our asses in this challenge. Maddie was whooping and hollering up a storm, which, by the way, totally tangential to this. Shannon, I've spent decades searching for a new Bobby John Drinkard in the Survivor, you know, casts around the world. At first, I was willing to walk into this podcast saying that Johnny Boy was our Bobby John, our Australian Bobby John. But I honestly think Matt is our Australian Bobby John, which I love in that he goes so aggro during these challenges, but he is the nicest and sweetest guy, apparently, as soon as you step off that court.
Is he the nicest, sweetest guy? Have we seen that? Because I just see him shoving Harry when Harry's coming in for a victory hug.
Well, that's still on the court.
Right,
still,
but I haven't seen the other stuff. This is all I know about this man.
Matt. I mean, look at the way he was treating Sarah. You know, look at the stuff with Laura in terms of, like, how nicely he was treating her. I do feel like he's a fundamentally nice guy.
The Sarah stuff, he was being nice, but, like, it was, I agree. I mean, but it was still within that, like, physical standpoint. With Laura, it was all in the physical standpoint. And, like, I get that he's trying to pump up his allies in the challenges, but, oh my God, if I was his tribe mate, I would be terrified. He is not a personal trainer that I feel like I would want to. He just is yelling at you.
But that's Bobby John. Remember, Bobby John would scream his ever-loving Alabama head off, and people would get freaked out until they sort of realized that was his thing. And now we've come around to, you know, Matt in the river bragging about, like, is there anything I can't do? And everyone's just laughing it off, when two episodes ago he was called a total idiot by Abby.
Great strategy, though, to brag about how good you are in the challenges as we're coming up to emerge. Really just A-plus strategy there.
I will also say, maybe it's also colored by the fact that I think he is very self-deprecating on social media as well, to the point where I believe he's changed his, like, Twitter name to, like, Idiot Matt.
That's the thing, it's like, yeah, he seems to be self-deprecating, but then he also is, like, laughingly also complaining about it. Like, I think it gets to him more than his front would like you to suggest. I'm sorry, I can't come here and sing Matt's praises. Like, I think in my notes, I was just like, why Matt? Like, 15 times. Who acts like this? I know it's on the court, but the court is still the game. Who shoves their allies away and yells at the other side and brags about how good they are at challenges, I cannot endorse.
I'm trying to remember where this conversation was before I ended up getting
why
down
that
the
why is what we're trying to where we're trying to go with this, I think.
Yeah, but basically, oh yeah, so Daisy is it's, you know, the contenders were like, okay, we got to make sure we're going in strong no matter what. And, you know, when it comes to pointing fingers, when I'm assuming they merge and you have people like Harry and Casey and maybe even Matt and Sean saying, oh, yeah, who is the one to decide to get rid of Sam? Fingers are going to be pointing at Daisy. Yeah. And that's going to unfortunately put her in a bad position. Whereas, you know, John and Baden are able to get much more scot-free with things. And I think Baden is in a really good position as well. If, like you said, if this tribe just keeps losing and it ends up with those five being, you know, the top five in the tribe, Baden is in a sublime position between two pairs where he's essentially the swing vote. I also love it because finally I've been waiting to pull out the Baden switch pun. And we finally got it here in what he did this episode.
Yeah, we finally got it at his second ever tribal council. Yeah, I totally take your point. For Daisy, you know, the next episode, she's the one whose name is being thrown out there. So that's not great. And, you know, it's still early on in the game to be making waves. But at the same time, unfortunately, her name was being thrown out. And I guess a lot of the issues are the dynamics on the contenders tribe. And I want to talk about Andy because he's someone that we obviously saw overplay a lot here, and I think a lot of his problem was that no one wanted to work with him, and I think that's not really being spoken about, and we'll definitely talk about the more egregious, louder, bigger things he was doing, but beyond that, it's like, it seems like a lot of it stemmed from the paranoia of Hannah and Sarah flipping, which we actually see might have been a little bit legit based on Hannah's voting confessional on the template website, so okay, maybe that paranoia was a tiny bit founded, but also not great that Hannah and Sarah wanted to flip away from you. And then obviously your three other allies literally did flip away from you. So I think that kind of in the way with Daisy and Sam, you can talk about the move all you want. It's like it was a move made out of necessity. Sam goes home. Daisy puts herself out in front, which might not be good. And it's based on the fact that there was such an extreme fracture in a tribe that had barely been to tribal council.
Yeah, let's talk about Andy here. Because
I have a lot on Andy.
Understandably, this is the most content he got since the very first week, where it's almost like we had like an Andy Valley of content, where last week there was really nothing about him, and then he came back strong. Full disclosure, I'm going to be the third guest in a row, Shannon, to say I have met Andy before. I have talked with Andy on two separate occasions. There was one where the Survivor 35 know-it-alls in New York City was probably the biggest one we've ever done. It was at a big movie theater in Lincoln Center. I had a very nice talk with him on the walk from the VIP party to the theater himself. He had been subletting, I believe, in New York at the time. So we talked a bit about New York and we talked a bit about Survivor. And then about 6 months later, I met him at the Ghost Island rap party when I went out there for my very first finale. So it was almost like, I don't know, I had him in my brain for an entire year before he ended up going out to play Survivor. I actually believe that night he was trying to convince Rob to go out to play Survivor, to sort of like put his visor where his head was and decided to fly out and do it himself. But I do wonder how much of the Max Dawson thing is going on here, Shannon. How much, because there's been a lot of accusations being bandied about, especially, you know, in episode 7. How much was Andy trying to play things up for television's sake with all the machinations from that episode?
The foot is all the way in the pot with the Max Dawson comparison. And yeah, I mean, he put up that whole blog post basically being like, I wasn't mugging for the camera. I had reasons for all these things, but like, it didn't really make it better for me because the reasons were all based on, as I've said, a lack of the good relationships built on the contenders tribe, which is basically you're a tribe not going to tribal council. Like, surely all you can do is sit there, hopefully not piss anyone off, make allies that you can use later down the game, and not make relationships where immediately you're all flipping on each other. That would be, I think, best case scenario for a tribe that literally doesn't even have to vote each other out and even show where the dynamics are. So, but, you know, I think it was showing kind of those unsteady relationships. It was obviously showing a lot of paranoia. I think a lot of overplaying. He was mugging for the camera. You know, say what you want. There was a lot of mugging for the camera there. And hey, let's go through the list of what Andy did in these couple of episodes. All right. So he told
Andy's list.
Yeah. Okay. Well, he told his allies about the idol to ensure no one flipped, which I don't know if it was necessary, and also it was the extremely wrong way to go about it. I mean, definitely talk to Daisy, who is Sean's main ally, about why you think that's necessary. Connect over the fact that Sean brought you in, instead of telling everyone but her and John, and then being overheard by her. How was he overheard in two separate episodes by the person he was talking about? That's insane. That's a bad track record of being overheard.
I mean, I'll also blame the other people talking to him for not being like, hey, Ixnay on the AZ day. She's right behind you.
Wow, twice in two episodes.
It's shades of back in Edge of Extinction when Ron Clark and Victoria were shit talking Joe like 3 feet away from Joe. I don't know if it's just the survivor blinders or something. Maybe that visor.
Yes. Oh, my God. Like, we literally worked it out. It's the visor.
Yeah, it's the double edged visor where it works so well for you or that it works so against you. I totally think that he should have talked to Daisy about it before. I agree, because that's shared information between them, and he wants, I think, to make their relationship feel special. I think maybe another reason why she flipped to tribal is because she's like, why did Andy whisper to John and not to me? So that's a way to sort of build that relationship. I do understand the intention behind him revealing the idol, though, because I think he was sort of feeling what apparently was happening, which is, yes, these are seven contenders, but these are seven contenders that are not necessarily on the same page. And this is a little bit of, I wouldn't say a scare tactic, but a unifier, but basically saying like, hey, guys, this is our enemy and the enemies are out. You know, they have this weapon. We have to make sure we strip the weapon. Otherwise, one of us is going to get taken out. And he had a lot of fears that it was going to be him. I'm sure we'll talk about the coin flip of it all. From what I gleaned, I believe he was trying to avoid a Tyson and heroes versus villains scenario where, you know, if one or two people flip over to Luke or David and they play one of their idols, that still means that he goes home. He was trying to be, I think, very much in the camp of self-preservation, but he was trying to mask it under this, you know, community building. And I feel like that's where it may have got him in trouble.
Yeah, just so little trust in his allies, you know, basically Hannah and Sarah, not to flip. And they were flirting with it. I don't know. I mean, I'm going to talk to Sarah later, so I'd be interested to know how close they were to flipping, because that might change it. If they were like almost going to flip, then you can kind of excuse the paranoia. If they were like, look, we talked to Luke and David, but we were never going to do it, then it's just the completely wrong read on the situation. And it seems like everything was kind of built from that wrong read. And everything he was trying to do was kind of trying to strong arm people not to flip. But it was also kind of just making that chasm in the contenders even bigger in every single capacity. Because you look at like, okay, so the idol thing's an example. He's trying to kind of be like, this is why we can't flip. But he's now put off Daisy and she wants to flip. The coin toss, as you said, another really good example. He was thinking, okay, if
where
no
did,
one...
Where did he get a coin?
Apparently, it was in the blog. It washed up on the beach. You'll be hard-pressed to convince me that he didn't bring it there so that he could do his voting confessional. But okay, it washed up on the beach.
I don't want to know where he put that coin if he smuggled it in.
They probably found it when they found those beans. You know, they were all just together in basically what is like the room of requirement for the contenders. But
I want beans, I want tweezers, and I want a coin that will be determining my survivor success.
It's a really bad room of requirement, but it does make sense that exists. But so the coin toss, as you said, he's trying to make sure no one knows who's getting four votes so that one person can't flip, work with a Luke and David, tell them you're getting four votes, you've now saved yourself, and I'm flipping, now it's 3-2 to take out Andy rather than 2-3, you know, to take out you. But that, again, I think just puts people off because it's like, do you want to keep your allies in the dark? Like, is that a good thing? Is that a thing that makes it cohesive? I think that was well overplaying. I don't think it was necessary. I also thought, I don't know if he was thinking this, but it could be good in kind of, you know, ensuring David and Luke don't know who's getting the most votes. Because if someone like David knows Luke is getting four, he cannot play his idol and keep it around and have it not be flushed and just let Luke take the bullets because he's getting three votes. I don't know if he was thinking that. So I see some merit there after literally seeing no point to the coin toss at all. But I still think it was pretty much 98% unnecessary. And then the other one we'll talk about is the live tribal of it all. I literally just said to Josh Wiggler that we understated Australians do not stand up at tribal, Andy. And you just stood up at tribal, so you've embarrassed me is the first thing. But
however, I will give it up to Australian Survivor. Thank you so much for subtitling the whispering that goes on at Tribal Council so that the audience has at least an inkling of an idea of what's going on instead of just being left completely in the dark and then saying, wait, Julia's gone? Where did that come from?
Yes, the audience is apparently important, but so he apparently was so paranoid by the end that Hannah or Sarah or both of them would flip that he thought, look, the odds of Luke having the idol played on him is low because he knew David is the one who supposedly either had an idol or played an idol for PR or was like in the vicinity of an idol. So he was like, let me change John's vote to Luke so that he'll go home with the most votes, even if, you know, David plays an idol or, and, you know, someone flips on me. But again, it's just so paranoid. It made people seemingly put people even more offside in putting off Daisy. So I just think every single thing he had was in the hope to, you know, not make people flip. But you look at it and he was driving people to flip the entire time. And he was kind of like watching Hannah and Sarah and not watching the three other people that were flipping. So his read on every single person except Sam seemed to have been wrong.
I just love the fact that it's pumped out as such a simple vote from all sides, even Harry, the next episode. And it's just increasingly complicated by the minute. And look, as someone who loves good TV, I thought it made for amazing TV, especially the fallout of it all. There's that fantastic gif of Andy just sort of like staring, blinking into the abyss in the next episode of, oh my God, my overthinking royally screwed things up. But I do appreciate, whether incidental or not, the entertainment that he brought here. But yeah, I totally think that he was so untrusting of the people around him that he almost overly committed to the trust of very specific people, where, to your point, it almost pushed others away, being like, why do you keep, you know, it's almost like the lady doth protest too much. If you are so overly committed to this idea of us sticking together, does that mean that you have something else going on? Maybe I should pursue other plans where I'm going to be in a better spot. So look, I appreciate the gameplay, and especially, we talk about this time and time again, I can't imagine super fans, let alone ultra fans, being out there sitting on their hands for 2 weeks and then finally getting an opportunity to play. In this case, it just was not playing that well.
Yeah, and I would have preferred if the blog post was like, look, I've been wanting to play this game for years. I was pumped up about playing it. I sat on the beach, went to one tribal council for several weeks, and I was overplaying just because I'm a super fan and that's what we crazy people do. But it was worse to me that he was like, well, I had the wrong read on these people and I didn't have the necessary relationships. And like, yeah, I think that's worse mistakes than just being like, I went too far. And he was way too pumped up about the strategy of this, being like, what a plan. Look, you have a 7-2 swap majority, okay? Just take it and quietly use it. You don't need to be talking about the great strategy. And then it screwed up in literally every way. And also, if they hadn't have had all these flips, Luke and David did have two idols. So again, there was a lot wrong, unfortunately, for Andy. Obviously, in Survivor South Africa, we do the Doof of the Week, which is the worst player of the week. And I hate to say it, but it's really hard not for that to be really obviously Andy in this week. And it continues on in the next episode where he's like, David is my main ally. And David's like, he's not even worth getting rid of, is how useless he is. Like, painfully doofy.
My heart goes out for him. And it's so interesting because Andy, I tweeted this out, was such, I don't know, I do not want to paint all of us super slash ultra fans into like a little corner of, hey, we all suck at challenges and suck socially. We're just a bunch of indoor kids. Aren't we bad at Survivor? But I was so astounded by the fact that Andy was, and still might be, one of the best challenge performers left in the game, in terms of, he was just such a ringer in every single challenge for those contenders. But it was a little sad to see him just be so, like, I want to say in love with David, but being like, well, any porn is storm. Hey, buddy, listen, I was trying to keep the votes off of you.
Which he was, trust but me. Actually for personal reasons.
Yeah, for himself.
Yeah.
But I do love the editing of it, just cutting back to David and being like, yeah, you're full of shit. But you know what? I know you're full of shit, so that makes you inherently less dangerous. So from that perspective, Andy almost unconsciously saved himself. Though I will say I was a bit duped by the edit here, Shannon. I think Sarah had enough content where I could have seen her stick to the episode, and I totally thought that we might see Andy go here.
Yeah, I didn't think so, because Andy's just been such a big character. He is so helpful in those challenges compared to Sarah. It's a more cohesive vote. I mean, look, Andy, even though he did get caught out doing it, was giving Daisy relevant information, and and Sarah was throwing out Daisy's name, and Andy was kind of like, you know, playing the good kid and kind of going with the majority and not making waves in a way Sarah was against the majority. So in terms of keeping it cohesive, in terms of obviously winning challenges, I did think Sarah was the obvious vote here.
Yeah, and actually, that's a great point where, you know, I think, unfortunately, Andy does get caught in. And this wasn't behind his back. This was in front of his face, which I guess is worse, where he's talking to Daisy's shelter.
That visor is really blinding.
Oh, my goodness. And then from that angle, we see Sarah approach the camp. This poor guy needs to go, like, 30 miles out in the ocean to have a conversation with somebody at this point. And then even then, like, I don't know, David in a helicopter is going to overhear him. But like you said, I don't think he was doing anything bad here. I mean, I guess he was, you know, Sarah and Hannah were so convinced that, and their plan, I admire Sarah for really trying to claw her way up from the bottom. But I think hoping for a 4-4 tie is really grasping at straws. So I don't know if I'm in that situation, I don't know how much it would begrudge me to really be like, how dare Andy leak this plan of me trying to force a tie vote that he kind of seemed to go along with. But on another note, this is also an opportunity for her to throw him under the bus. And the others did a pretty good job performing it to try to entertain the notion. I mean, David just likes to be like, well, how, David just loves to play contrarian sometimes. He'll just stand out there. He'll be like, how about Luke? Even though he won't go through with Luke, he just likes to throw the name out to see how people react. And he sort of did that there with Andy. But I feel like the more egregious stuff definitely happened in episode 7 over episode 8. I think episode 8, he did a fine job trying to tuck his tail between his legs. It just turned out that one of the other dogs that happened to, you know, be in the pound with him was trying to big dog him. And the other dog just sort of ganged up on that dog.
Okay, fine, if that's the way that you saw it. Look, we're an hour and a quarter into this podcast, and we haven't spoken about Sam, which I think is apt. So let's talk about Sam, the first person in the history of the game to leave with 0 votes. And honestly, like, it is unsettling to me that we'll never see what her Chiron would have said. Like, we'll never see that lower third. We have no idea what the show would have described her job as.
What was she? Because she didn't even get an intro video.
Yeah, she got 0 confessionals. I think she was casino manager. Honestly, it was weird getting on the exit interview and, like, hearing her voice. I was like, this is a bizarre situation for me.
What if someone, like, catfished you, pretending to be Sam calling you?
It's funny because just, like, a little bit of, like, inside Shmogen Brawl, like, every single time that we get on the line and it's the PR person, I'm always like, hi, Anastasia. And she's like, nope, it's the PR. Like, everything. And, like, with Sam, she could have done the entire interview and I would have just been like, okay, I have no idea. So, yeah, that was a weird one for me. And look, Twitter is mad on her behalf that she got no confessionals. And I totally see that. I mean, that is brutal. She also said on social media, like, her story is terrible. I mean, in the 2 months before she left, she lost her grandfather and her father. So I can't even imagine. I mean, there was definitely story there. I don't know if that's something they even wanted to show or kind of, I mean, obviously it's been done before with Henry having lost his mom right before coming out. So they obviously didn't feel that she was necessary enough to show. And look, the show doesn't owe her content. Like, she doesn't go out there signing a form about how many confessionals she requires. So she doesn't need content for content's sake for me, even though I do think it was brutal. But I do think it's about the viewer. Like, it's about me watching the show. And this is where they dropped the ball, because firstly, every single person should get their intro package in the first 3 episodes of the show. I'm saying that unequivocally. That's 4 hours of pure content. You have the time. We kind of roll them out to us over the first 3 episodes. We need to know the pieces on the board. So 100% we should be getting every single person's intro package towards the beginning. And then in terms of the confessional she needed, I don't just want her to get a random confessional just so you can say, wow, she got one confessional, now she can leave the door like Hope from Survivor Karamoan. What I would like is the relevant confessionals. I want to see where she feels she fits in the contenders, what the issue is with Daisy. You know, at first I thought she was going to get like double idled out, which would have been, I guess, a little bit more random and maybe a bit more relevant for her not to have confessionals, because how do you even explain that other than David just being pissed off that she shut him down, which we saw. But no, it was literally based on a long-standing antagonistic relationship with Daisy. Show me that. Show me that content. So while for me, the episode was still extremely satisfying, as I said, I loved it, and I understood her place in the context of the episode, because She was basically this nameless, faceless representative of this huge contender mass, She was the antagonist for the two biggest players in the game, who you're obviously rooting for in David and Luke. And she was a proxy for Andy, who's a huge character. So I understand her place, but I didn't know her as a character. I didn't know some of the personal dynamics that led to her demise, which is a problem. And I know stuff about her, like she was on The Amazing Race and her job, I guess, and some of the other stuff, because I researched it and I have a podcast about it and I'm a super fan. The casuals are beyond confused. Like, that was the main thing my parents were saying. They were like, I like the episode, but I don't know that woman. I don't know who that woman was. And 99% of this audience are casuals. And I think introduce us to the players in 8 episodes and roughly 4,000 hours of the show.
Yeah, I would say maybe cut out a few Luke and David confessionals in the first 3 episodes.
No, I'm joking. Definitely, that's, cut out some of the repetitive confessionals and introduce us to every player in the game.
Yeah, because also there's a thing of like, well, it sort of got jinxed here, but you say like, oh, this person hasn't had an intro package yet. You know that they're going to survive until, you know, in the next episode, because we haven't seen an intro package from them yet. Again, Sam didn't get one, so I guess that's not going to be a trend, which, again, is a little unfair that, you know, we get some imbalance here. Though I guess if you have celebrities competing, that's want to do. Like I mentioned before, my concern is not necessarily with everyone needs an equal number of confessionals. Everyone needs a story, because depending on the storylines that they want to create, people aren't necessarily going to be involved. You know, I feel like Australian Survivor, especially, and whether it's due to the number of episodes or just the way that they do things, they really tend to do every episode, these are the main people who are involved. And maybe the next episode, they might not be involved as much. It just so happens that Luke and David, since their tribe has now gone to tribal 7 out of the 8 episodes, have been huge in each and every episode. Whereas, like we said, Andy really popped in the first couple episodes when the contenders were going to tribal council, and then he disappeared for a long time. So it's really tough to read the edit in that regard. But I mean, you don't need to be the main character, but be a supporting character, be a day player. Sam was an extra in
but
this
show
story.
Us the one storyline as well that literally leads to her going home.
Or at least, like I said, like, just show me Daisy feeling like she feels sequestered from the rest of the girls. And maybe you can say that Sam is the head. Lord knows, I definitely want to get into Australian Survivor editing, because I feel like the Frankenbites were out and they were maybe at their worst this week. But they could cobble together something along the lines of Sam being the head of the contender girls. But that's the thing for me, is I totally, you know, my heart goes out to Sam, especially as a reality TV veteran. It must be disheartening to see her story promptly so erased. I can understand what people are saying about how this is more so a Rise of David and Luke storyline more than anything. But at the same time, I promptly feel like Survivor should always provide us with a sound reason every week as to why that person went home, even if it's just to the betterment of the players that are currently in the game. From what we were being told, I really did not know that much why Sam left. And I feel like that is a failure on the editor's part. There's a lot of good to Australian Survivor editing that I want to get into very, very soon. But I feel like this was, unfortunately, one of the spurs in the heel that a lot of people had trouble with. Like you said, for the first time in any English speaking Survivor franchise, a person got 0 confessionals over the course of their game. It's sad, and it's also a bit, I don't know, there could have been a lot more, or at least a little bit more to be done to at least give her boots some relevance in the overall story, or at least be more cogent.
Yeah, this is an uncomfortable precedent, and I think that a lot of the superfans got blindsided by the metagame, which is not really how you want to be blindsided by the show. Of, you know, we were all like, I mean, I still thought that she would go over definitely Luke and possibly David, who just, I didn't see this being the end of his story, but we always say, you know, at least if you have no confessionals, you're safe. You know, you're safe in that bubble of invisibility. And no longer, uncomfortable precedent has been set. Hannah still doesn't have a confessional. Where will it go from here? I still think, you know, I got it, because it was Luke and David versus Andy, and Sam was just like an invisible piece within that. And maybe if they had idled her out, it would be somewhat fair. I still think she should be introduced to us so we literally know the 24 people on off screen. It is a lot, but they have so much time. And especially considering so much of it was to do with her relationships and her game, we definitely needed to see that. But I'm interested to hear, you know, your take on the editing at large.
So there's good and there's bad. I think that it's a mixed bag, and it makes sense just given if you pursue a specific storytelling style. I think that, you know, there are pros and there are cons to it. Let me start with the pros and not the professional athletes. I think that they do such a great job at building up surprise. I think that when it comes to, you know, we talk on Survivor South Africa about how they pursue a more warts and all edit where it almost, you know, sacrifices suspense in lieu of really letting us know each and every element behind what happens on a vote, which has garnered some complaints from the audience that might be used to a more westernized, you know, edit of the show. This is much more akin to the American version where there's an option A and there's an option B, even if there really isn't an option B. And we don't know what's happening, you know, until the vote, till the pen hits the parchment and we get to tribal council. And I feel like there have been some big moments. You mentioned those two big flips, which were just built up as so seismic and such fun TV moments. Like I mentioned before, I think the challenges are not only epic. Yes, we spend a lot of time in them, but I love how they're done. So I'm fine spending time in there, especially with the extended episodes. But I love the crosstalk. I love the character moments that come out, whether it's Baden dropping mid-sentence and then waving to the camera.
I love that.
You know, whether it's Ross trying to push JLP in a rushing river, whether it's, you know, Matt telling Daisy that she has a reward in the form of David slinking an arm around her. It's those little moments that I feel like we have to cut, unfortunately, on a U.S. Survivor episode that only runs 42 minutes. I love that they emphasize camp life as well, because we get so many great character moments. Namely, I'm sad we haven't talked about him. I love David and I love Luke, but Ross might be a very close bronze medalist to me. I love all the random stuff they have him do. You know, he starts off in episode 6 like a pig in mud, pouring water down his bathing suit, just doing a bunch of random Ross things. And I like those moments because, again, that's character building moments. We might not get intro packages from everyone, but we get to see people behave in the game in a certain way that makes me really happy. Moving over to the not so fun stuff, we already mentioned the imbalance of confessionals, which, again, I don't have necessarily a problem with. I just want people to have a place in the story, and I don't know if Sam necessarily had a place here. The Frankenbites.
We don't know her profession. She definitely didn't have a place.
The Frankenbites have gone. I feel like the monster has escaped the lab, Shannon, and has gotten out of control this season. Maybe it's just me. We're going to get into Harry's fantastic kid lie, but, you know, there's a question as to, like, well, why didn't the contenders just, you know, pull a PN and a Simon and be like, Harry, you never mentioned your kid. It's very clear when you see the confessionals cobbled together from Harry's facial hair that he says this early on in the game as well, which makes me assume this is a lie he spread to everybody in the game. There was an episode 8, another Harry Frankenbite, where he literally goes, I can't believe the old contenders voted out Sam. Like, it's so clearly spliced together from four different confessionals that it sounds so fabricated to just create a story when I'm sure he had a confessional where his number one ally went home and he was dispirited. And on that note, I think the repetition of confessionals, as you mentioned, can just get really, especially if you're watching these three episodes 3 days in a row. I mean, again, I love David, but when you have him in your ears so often gloating about his situation, it wears old after a while. There's only so many words in the English language, Shannon, that can be synonyms of one another. And I feel like we have plumbed that well dry. They have poured the word water down their bathing suit at this point. I don't know how much is left in the confessional well. So, like I said, what they're pursuing is really admirable and it produces some really, really fun moments, but at the expense, unfortunately, at some other specifically confessional based editing choices that I'm not necessarily a big fan of.
Yeah, I think I find Luke and David so entertaining that I don't mind it as much as I did with Benji, which was, like, honestly, they wasn't even synonyms. It was just literally the same words.
The Godfather, the Godfather, the Godfather.
Yeah, and I like Benji too, and it was still way too much. And I think definitely, like, Luke actually hasn't had that many confessionals since the first three episodes. It's been a lot of David, who I also find entertaining, and I don't know if we'll have him for that long, so because I think the downfall is coming, but I think I just find that more entertaining than I probably should, considering how repetitive it is. But in terms of like the Frankenbites, as you said, for Harry, I mean, we have to talk about Harry's fake baby, my favorite thing ever. And I was kicking myself that I didn't ask Sam about what he'd said on Condender Beach. As I said, I'm going to be talking to Sarah later, and I'm definitely going to be asking, like, did Harry tell you he had a child? Why? Why did he do this? I mean, I loved every single part of it so much. It's insane. And, you know, Dez from Ghost Island had said that she wanted to come in the game in the preseason and say she had a child. And I was like, oh my God, I would love that. And then she got off the show and they were like, well, why didn't you do that? She was like, well, that's impossible. I can't tell people that I have a child. I realized on the island that would literally change me as a person in every capacity, and that I can't keep that lie up. And I've lamented people lying about their jobs. Harry just concocted a human being. It's such good TV, especially because we don't know that much else about Harry before this week. And he's just like the guy with the fake child. Iconic TV.
Yeah. If we don't know Sam's jobs, we now know four of Harry's. He's an ice cream maker. He's a dietitian. He's a chef. I love Harry's coming out party.
Was that the fourth one? Because he didn't say the fourth one. And also chef and ice cream maker, they're part of the same thing. Chef is the umbrella term, surely, of ice cream maker. And dietitian is a funny one with ice cream maker. So a lot of intrigue there.
I wonder if it's a thing where he like puts on a mustache or pretends to be somebody different when he's a dietitian. Otherwise, I think that would besmirch his reputation, would it not?
But imagine if he's a dietitian. He's like, okay, what I'm seeing is that you need to eat a lot of ice cream. Here's a card of this other guy.
Then he's the most popular. He's the most popular dietitian around. He's like, just go down to this guy. He's just going to tell you to eat a bunch of ice cream. So I loved the heck out of this. To be frankly, Frank, I'm very surprised that in nearly two decades of Survivor, nobody has had the whale balls to actually go out and do this.
No, it's not surprising. That's an insane person thing to do.
But I feel
no
like
we've had in 50 years of Survivor.
We had someone make up a dead relative back in 2003. I thought that, you know, soon afterwards it would be, you know, the opposite, the birth instead of the death. Just because, I mean, he can come up with details. I know that. I understand what Dez is saying, and I have experienced it as well, even in the past 3 months, about how much parenting fundamentally changes you. But they don't know who you are before coming out onto the island. They could just think that this is Dad Harry. Dad Harry is just a weird guy. I do have some umbrage with the age that he chose, because I think there could have been a smarter strategy here in the number.
Okay, you're the dad, the fake dad, so please let me know what the age of his fake child should have been.
So he said what? That he's like 2 going on 3. I feel like, from what I've talked about with a lot of other parents, because there have been a lot of conversation with other parents, especially of like 2 to 3 year olds, there are so many more details involved with 2 to 3 year olds.
So right? This is something that I don't know and Harry doesn't know because we're not parents. That's why he did the bad age.
Well, 2 to 3 year olds, like, you're taking them to preschool, you're getting them potty trained, they're starting to, you know, maybe sleep outside of a crib and go into a bed a little bit. And so I feel like while that might bring up more topic points with these other champions who have kids, there's going to be a lot bigger of a chance that you are caught in something that you don't know about. I think the optimal age you want to make up your fake kid as is 6 months to a year, because that kid is not really going anywhere. Maybe Oscar's crawling, maybe he's walking a little bit, but there aren't so many persnickety details that you need to bring up. You know, it's not so many things you need to fabricate and keep your story straight. If you're going to do this, you want to keep the most detail-free narrative possible. And so I feel like the younger you keep him, the better. And plus, it also avoids, like, if you make up, like, oh, he's 2 to 3 months old, then you're called a monster, much like Luke was for abandoning your child that young and your poor Chicago girlfriend. Which, by the
is
way,
his girlfriend actually from Chicago? I don't know who this man is.
I don't know, because I know in the United States, when people like to make up girlfriends, they like to say that their girlfriend's from Canada. Is that the Australian version, Shannon? If people make up their girlfriends, do they say they're from Chicago?
I would think it should be New Zealand. That's our Canada.
Yeah, I guess so. Though maybe it's close enough that they could sort of fact check there. But
I don't understand. What is the situation? I mean, so his girlfriend lives in Chicago, which is really far away. How often does he see Oscar? Like, I know it's not a real story, but I'm like concerned for him. He needs the money so he can go visit Oscar.
Well, I don't know if she's from Chicago or in Chicago.
Okay.
I think maybe she came from Chicago. I mean, listen, she was around enough for them to have a nice little intro package of them smooching in front of a Ferris wheel.
So is maybe that she's person sort of like real? American. Is that an actress that he hired? I don't trust anything Harry says. He made up a
maybe,
child.
maybe there's a production plant who was hired to play Sam in your exit interview, who's Harry's stand-in girlfriend, this like one person from Central Casting who's just the eternal stand-in for all these people that I they can't duped. Get.
Yeah.
So I love this. I think it's going to fall apart for him very quick. I love the effort, though. Like, he very accurately called out his spot from the bottom. But when it comes to making up a fake child versus finding an idol, a fake baby versus a new baby, I think one very much outweighs the other in terms of game metal.
In terms of, like, you know, lying about your profession, I feel like parenting is one of the hardest, most confusing jobs in the world. Something that I would have no idea how to do that if I wasn't a parent. And it's like coming out there and being like, I'm like an engineer, and then having like a whole tribe of engineers being like, tell me about this very specific engineering thing. That's why I feel like what it's like to say, like, I'm the parent of a toddler, and all of these parents are like, oh, what a great age, as you said, tell me every single detail. And he's like, okay, you know, like, it's such a difficult thing to pretend to be. And I honestly think, like, forgive the pun, but fake killing off a relative like Johnny Fairplay did is child's play compared to concocting a human being. Like, how often do you talk about whether your grandma is sick or alive? Like, I can see that not really coming up. But your child, surely, Mike, you with your fake baby know that surely the baby would come up a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think, you know, I can understand where he was coming from.
No,
I think that,
no, well, we're not endorsing that he made up a fake child. There's no one. That's pure insanity.
Yes,
do
I think
not endorse.
All Survivor players make up children, promise Survivor play dates that are never going to happen. You know what? Marry off your Survivor fake children. Okay, make dynasties of Survivor offspring that are fabricated, that are blown to the winds, just to progress yourselves in the game. I mean, he was looking for any sort of rung on a social ladder,
but
to
he
climb.
Did it at Convendors too. There was no point to this. No
well,
point.
Yeah, I wonder. I do want to hear about that as well. I wonder if that's the case where he was just trying to like come up with a sob story, almost, because I don't think
having a toddler is not a sob story either. It does nothing. It just changes who you are at every day to day interaction you have with these people.
I'm trying to think. Was Sarah the only parent on the Contenders tribe? Because I guess if he really wanted
Sean
to get in with her,
a child. I'm trying to think who else.
Yeah, maybe he suggested. Oh, he does. Yeah, he has two. He has two boys. Maybe he wanted to get in with them, so he made this up spur of the moment, and then was like, "Oh crap, this is gonna get out." Okay, I guess I'm a dad now. I mean, I was a little suspicious when, you know, the Contenders won that box of supplies, and he did not ask for the world's best dad mug. He didn't drink the coffee with that. You would think that would be the, you know, the best thing to do as a new dad. I also think 6 months to a year is great, is because when kids are at that age, everybody has advice to offer. So you're going to get them talking and you're not going to be talking that much, which is, I think, what he optimally wanted to go for, and unfortunately may have failed at in the age he chose for his fake child.
Yeah. So the only way I could think this would be relevant is, look, it ensures you don't pull a Sam. You're going to get a confessional where you talk about your fake child. That's the only way that I'm going to give it any credibility. And, you know, to briefly touch on the idol, that was better for his game for sure. I did love how he talked about how he wants to use it for all the Contenders. Cut to Casey/Cassie immediately throwing him under the bus. Apparently Sean threw him under the bus. So that's not wonderful either. I mean, we see kind of Casey/Cassie. I'm now like literally, I'm confusing myself in a legitimate
way.
I need to stop.
Shannon, I think Cassie is the name of our mystery stand-in. I think that's why Janine got confused, is because she had seen her around before and was like, oh, Cassie, wait, no, Casey, now I'm getting confused.
She played Hannah sometimes, she played Sam sometimes, she was a body double.
Yes, exactly. This is our Survivor stunt double. Exactly. Like, Sarah should have just tapped out during the Tower of Terror challenge and had Cassie drive off.
Yeah, well, okay, so well, at least Casey is appealing to them in a genuine way as a number, kind of working out who's at the top of the power structure, which is those women, and appealing to them without having to make up a descendant. This is crazy. I loved it. People should be watching Australian Survivor.
Let's make a bet here. What episode number will Harry make a promise and swear on his child's life?
Oh my God. He did it already. We just haven't seen it. But we'll see it Frankenbited in like episode 11.
I'm going to say give me episode 14. I think he's going to make the merge, especially if the Contenders keep winning these challenges. But I feel like he's going to do it at least once. I really hope he makes the final tribal council so he can pull a fake Jeremy Collins and be like, I have this 2-year-old at home who really could use these $500,000. And then just to go to the finale, to the reunion, and just see how pissed off everyone is at this fake child. I mean, this is completely asinine, but I absolutely love it because it's fantastic entertainment and it's never been done before. And unlike the Sam stuff, it's never been done before in a good way.
Oh my God. Australian Survivor is on point at the moment. And now a quick break to hear from our sponsors.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And we are back. All right, Mike, let's get into the chizzy after we've broken down these three episodes in pretty significant fashion. So take it away, Jacob Sager Weinstein and MC Color.
1, 2, 3.
The chizzy is like really difficult with three episodes. It's a lot of gameplay, and I feel like I have to weight my points based on significance. So they're pretty much based on that middle episode where like all the dynamics were. So I'll go now and just give my points, and then you can give your points, Mike. Okay, I'm gonna have to be very similar to last week, and I'm sorry because it's really not my bias showing. And I hope this isn't annoying people because it's coming from a really genuine place. I have to give 3 to Luke. I'm sorry. I can't think of a more ideal 8 episodes for someone. I mean, he's now flipped the votes out of the minority twice from 2 impossible situations he had no control over, including a champion's tribe that knew each other pregame and a terrible swap. He does have a lot to do with it. It's all in his social game. He's universally beloved. So brave. Whale balls not to play his idol. What he and David pulled off was incredible. I'm sorry that I have to give him the most votes here. And then I'm going to give 2 to David again, because obviously he pulled off everything that Luke did. But I dock him a point because he's the one leading it out in front, which is not where you want to be. You know, he's the one kind of talking to Sarah about the vote and kind of leading it, while Luke's just kind of being a listening ear. And he's somehow, Luke is now the beta player. That is amazing to me. So David...
No, Baden's playing on him on the same tribe, though.
Fair is fair. Well, David is a shield for Luke, which is crazy, but he's pulled off a lot. As we said, he's a very good and a very bad player, and I've said that Chizzy is cursed, and it probably is, because the downfall is surely coming for David. Sean is about to look at his idol after it's sat in his bag for 2 weeks, which no one understands, but it's all going to come back to Biden, but I'm kind of amazed it hasn't happened sooner, and that he's been able to pull off as much as he did. Obviously, didn't play his idol as well, which is impressive, but yeah, I docked him a point there because of the terrible lies and also just for being the more alpha player, which you don't want to be. And I'm going to give a point to Davey, obviously, who facilitated the move. You know, she was able to facilitate it and lead the move because she was lucky enough and fortunate enough to have been swapped with the numbers. But it is still impressive. And we've talked about the pros and cons. I ultimately do come up that it was pro, certainly for the short term, probably for the long term. Nothing wrong with taking out someone who's apparently throwing your name out and, you know, controlling the tribe for at least this little bit. You know, it's unfortunate that her name does come up in the next episode, but they take that person out. So she's well insulated for now. I'm interested to see how this kind of all breaks down when we find out about the fake idol. But I also have to credit the champion girls as honorable mentions for, you know, making the right move in that first episode. But those are my points.
Interesting. We're going to have a very different breakdown here, which excites me. So I'm going to give 1 point to Darrow. I thought that his work this episode, no, listen, Darrow would teach like a master class with some of these people that are making decisions in Australian Survivor, and that's saying something.
I don't know, but okay.
just on being Darrow, just on getting the burgers all over his face. I'm gonna give 1 point to Casey, which is crazy because I didn't think that this person existed until this week, but there are 2 big things that I thought she did really well. Maybe accidentally, maybe on purpose. First was up on that perch when maybe to alleviate her own fears, she talked with Pia and Simon and happened to reveal that information that David told Sean that he played an idol on Pia. Nothing was done with that information, but I feel like maybe if it was, you know, if there were different circumstances, that could have very easily sunk David's game and summarily changed the entire course of the game from then on. And on top of that, she found herself in a pretty bad position, you know, admittedly on the bottom two of this new contenders tribe. And like you said, I think she made the completely right move in endearing herself to the women of the former champions. I think that she did what Harry was kind of trying to do with Oscar, but she, you know, she essentially
made up her own baby. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. She's just appealed to them with her own personality. And it seems like though Harry does have an idol, it seems like she has staved off a position on the bottom rung of the ladder. So I give her some credit there, and I'm happy that we're finally getting to see some of her. I'm going to give 2 points to Baden because I really think that, you know, we just saw so much from the TV edit that he was, even though Daisy said he wasn't, he seemed to be someone who barely survived the first vote on the contenders. Even though he had proved himself in the challenges, who knows what would have happened had they gone again before this swap. He swaps over, sees the opportunity, becomes this big swing vote. I think he's now in a really good position. And I just think that he has a really good hold on this game and is in a very safe spot for someone who was in such danger in the first week. So just from a pure improvement perspective, I'm giving him points there. Bonus points for him confusing Ross by talking about the ionosphere, which was just absolute gold. I think Ross, by the way, is the Keith Nail of Australian Survivor. What do you think about that?
People are saying Brian Lake in terms of this crazy champion man. I mean, Brian Lake was definitely putting the well water down his pants, right?
I mean, hopefully, because he was making water as well. So I don't know. I just feel like Keith Nail, in terms of like just being so joking, but like so much like he really is like an Australian good old boy. John sort of is as well. But I don't know. I feel like Ross just has that on lock in terms of lovability. And I'm going to agree with you. I'm giving 3 points to Lukey here.
Oh, we've cursed Luke. No,
I know. But I really do feel like he got all of these benefits of, you know, surviving with his idol intact, now in this power position, but also not being so out in front as David. I think that is, he really is in one of the best positions of the entire game right now, in that he ended up getting himself a meat shield, who in himself has a meat shield in the form of an idol. He's shielded doubly, triply, if you count his own idol. So I think that he's in a fantastic position, and he really is getting on with everybody to the point where, again, E.T., someone who was not in his alliance, was rooting for him on the way out, really speaks to just how well Luke gets on with everybody. And in Australian Survivor, where over the course of 55 days, you are really jonesing for someone you like by the end of it. And that really contributed to, you know, the 3 wins that we've had so far. Luke's in a great position there. I'll give a couple of honorable mentions. I'll give one to Daisy. Like you said, I think if you incorporate the stuff we heard about from contenders, the move makes more sense. I'm just still a little hesitant about her being out so out in front as the face of that, where depending it where they merge, that might come back to bite her. I put Harry in here as well, even though he ended up on the bottom here and the kid might not have helped, even though it really helped our conversation here. He did find an idol, so that's going to keep him around at least one more round. And yeah, my Australian dream girls are just going to keep on singing, I think, hopefully to the merge. So there's a lot of people to spread the points around. And I'm hopeful that we, you know, popped a lot of chizzy cherries this week.
Yeah, I mean, so many great characters. I do hope for Luke that David is a shield and not his demise, because it's like, it's good to have a shield, but sometimes you don't want to stand too close to that fire. And that is a concern for me as I lie awake at night worrying about Luke in the game. But he really has, he's done so well, and I guess he's now leading the Chizzy. We'll be putting Chizzy charts out on Twitter. I love that man. But another man that I love and I want to talk about is Jonathan LaPaglia. And I want to read out some just amazing JLP tweets. I mean, I don't think a host in the game could have a better Twitter game than JLP. It's so shady, which you know we love on our podcast. And
wait, even more so than the late Matt Chisholm, who called out trolls on his own account?
Matt Chisholm is very much alive, everyone, please. You just killed Kiwi Jeff fan, by the way. Like, I think listening to this,
Kiwi Jeff fan, I'm going to resuscitate you. He's very much well alive. His Survivor hosting skills are in a hiatus right now, but hopefully they'll be brought back to prominence soon, much like Andy's edit.
Well, JLP, I love that guy. And I mean, they should bottle his laugh. He really is just Jeff Probst crossed with Wolverine. And his tweets. Okay, let me read out some of these incredible tweets that he had. And also, it's a lot of shading Andy. It's pretty much all shading Andy. He said, okay, terrifyingly smart Andy considers David his closest ally. The guy who practically blindsided him off his stump at the last tribal council, thinking emoji. Cruel I do just love when terrifyingly smart, and they use that against him in Andy's own words.
That is a fantastic use of adverb and adjective, by the way. I love that word choice personally. Terrifyingly smart.
Maybe don't say it. I mean, maybe it was a Frankenbite, but surely don't say it after you've just been super blindsided.
Frankenbites are terrifyingly smart coming this Halloween.
He also said, Andy might be a goober fan with delusional tendencies, but he really is a good all-round athlete. That's such a terrible compliment. Like, if he just said Andy might be a goober fan, but he really is a good all-round athlete, that's fine. But he had to put in with delusional tendencies. Like, he's now, like, psychoanalyzing him.
Oh, I know Josh broke down the stratification of fan levels. Can we throw in a level for goober fan for the super fans that just completely flame out on Survivor? Those are the goober fans.
Yes, that is it. I'm so glad. I'll never even give myself a chance to get to goober fans. That's the first level of Survivor fandom I don't actually want. So that's
you're in pre-goober status.
I'll never go on the show because I know for a fact if I did, I would be a goober fan, and I don't want what happened to Addy to happen.
And
to
JLP
me.
Would just roast your ass like flame broiled burger from Steers.
He would. He definitely would. He also said, "I can confirm that no one has ever decided to vote on a coin toss." Yep, definitely a first. Eye roll emoji.
Wow.
I know.
I think he was saving in reserve all the reactions that he wanted to have for that tribal council, but he had to remain impartial to it.
Well, talk about it being impartial. These ones aren't about Andy, but he said, "Damn, I really wanted to see the fallout from last tribal, which was a cracker. Where the hell is the night vision?" Calling out the editors for not showing us the post-tribal content. Is JLP the editor's boss? Because imagine editing the show and going on Twitter to seeing him being like basically the Twitter version of "come into my office."
Yeah, or if he was like, "At James follows, you're fired. Please don't come in on Monday for your editing, you know, failures."
He also, this is the last one, it's not shady, but it's just inappropriate. He said, which apparently you will live on this podcast as we talk about whale balls. He says, "You need to get a good grip and give it a hard pull in this challenge, you filthy-minded heathens." We get away with a lot in Australia, huh?
As Mr. Full Bloom, I fully appreciate JLP's double entendres. So I'm here for JLP. I absolutely love him. I love how he's become also, I mean, we know that him and Luke had a good relationship, but I love that, you know, Ross has endeared himself to JLP as well. I think when Ross gets voted out, he's going to be able to get like a hug or a kiss on the cheek off of him.
Definitely, I agree. Well, we have some questions from the listeners, so let's get into what we haven't covered from these many episodes of Survivor. Jason Gates, who is my brother/intern, asks, "Boost Juice recently named a new juice. Goodbye, Stephen Bradbury. What will be the next Survivor-inspired menu item?" And before we start getting into the puns, Janine Alice, I bow down. I mean, the fact that she flipped the game, voted someone out, used it as a marketing ploy for her product. You know I love the integrated marketing on Survivor, and this is next level good. I am a Boost Juice stan. I actually really love Boost Juice. It's really good. I will only drink Boost Juice from now on. The other day I was out, and my mom was like, "Should we get a juice from Top Juice?" And I was like, "Garbage Top Juice. Never in a million years." I love this. And looking at the menu, there's a lot of berry items. Berry is like the core ingredient of Boost Juice. And I am putting it down to the universe that when Janine was looking at who to align with and who to vote out, she was like, "I have to vote out Stephen Bradbury because the marketing opportunities will be through the roof."
If and when you interview Janine, do you think she can make a flavor called Shannon Grapes?
That's all I want in life. I mean, I love the sponsors. And look, Boost isn't a sponsor, but like, they kind of are. I mean, they're in all the ad breaks.
Yeah.
They're making up drinks based on the contestant's name. Like, you're a sponsor.
Yeah, you have the founder of Boost Juice on the show that is sort of like, I don't know, secondhand advertising. I love that. I just love, like, it's not a personal grudge. It's almost like like adding insult to injury of like, "Hey, not only did we vote you out, but a year later, I'm going to name a flavor after you. So people are sipping your misery, Stephen Bradbury."
And people got spoiled because they got a notification from the Boost Juice app telling them to have the Goodbye Stephen Bradbury drink. Every part of this is just speaks to what I love about this community in very unique ways. And I went through the Boost Juice menu to try and think about what puns we could do. There was a lot of berry puns, as we've said, potential Simon Blackberry puns, but here are a few I came up with. There's a drink called Caribbean Green. So if she votes out Harry, who's obviously on her radar, I think she could do Harry being green with envy that he's not in the game. So yes, that's
with,
a long
with
one.
Extra, with extra Oscar oranges.
Exactly. She has the immunity blend, which, you know, is just a thing that exists. So maybe the immune ET blend, because they blended him in the vote.
No, well, I also love, by the way, again, this is why I love the camp life, the random conversation between the champion ones on the contenders about who they would want to eat on their tribe. It's weird, but as someone who also had that conversation once upon a time on a podcast, it really is a conversation after my own heart. I love the heck out of it.
Oh my God, I'm now concerned for Boost Juice. You know, is it people?
Boost Juice is people! Has anyone seen Stephen Bradbury recently?
Goodbye, Stephen Bradbury was a funny little pun until you realize he's in the drink.
Exactly. It was the final thing they said to him as they put him in the machine.
Oh my God. No wonder he really didn't seem to want to be at that exit interview. He was going to his demise.
You should have outwitted the machine, Stephen.
Oh my God. Well, did you look at the menu and have any puns based on this Boost Juice menu?
I haven't looked at the menu, but I feel like there could be something around like Baden and Barry, you know, like or Bananadin. Daisy. There's got to be something with Daisy, right? It's got to be like, I don't know, Crazy Daisy Durian.
Well, the problem is that really most of the drinks were based around berries. Like, really, Stephen Bradbury was like the perfect one. But I want to see the Harry Bean Green drink. If they do that, I will get it. It works for me. The sponsors work for me so well.
I think there should be an Andy themed drink called the Coin Flip, which is two completely different smoothies, one on top of the other, and you sort of flip it from either end to drink it.
And then accidentally spill it all over yourself, because as David was saying, he's basically forgetting where the mines are and stepping into them. So, yeah, I mean, amazing work by Janine. She should get chizzy points just for the marketing. Tom Hockman asks, are Harry and Oscar a must-have for Blood versus Water?
I mean,
look, your loved one can bring you down. Best case scenario, they're just not there.
Can you vote out something that doesn't exist? That's a head-scratcher for you, Ross.
Well, I think they just did with Sam, unfortunately.
Or you could it be like, I don't know, a George Glass scenario where Harry's like, Oscar's going to be coming eventually, and if you vote me out, he's going to come rain fire, just you wait. And so he's able to, like, almost rely on this reputation that he's built up for his two-year-old so that they never vote him out.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even begin to think about the layers of TV and strategy that now exists now that someone has made up a human being. It's beyond me. But Laurel Guionette asks, without being results-oriented, was it smart for the new contenders tribe to not throw that challenge? Which Luke obviously, unfortunately, had to publicly ask for, and only Luke can get away with that.
Yeah, so let's talk about that, because I think on paper, you absolutely do it. I think that you see the numbers and you see that it's two of your allies. And if you're Abby and Janine specifically, you say, yeah, we definitely do this because we have the numbers. I guess the two things I could think of the reason why they didn't do it is, one, Simon is on their tribe and there is a chance that he could be, very angry about what happened. I know Simon's showing an emotion, surprise, surprise, but he could be pissed that, you know, what happened to the 47 and he flips over to the contenders. The other thing is, I honestly can't remember, Shannon, was Henry from Australian Survivor 2017 the last time we saw somebody throw a challenge in Australian Survivor? Has this idea of champions versus contenders fostered an idea that you have to give all out in every single challenge?
I mean, well, one of the people is Abby, who's an actual athlete, so I think it might work on that level, but I really don't think they should have thrown the challenge. It's the kind of thing where from our couch, we're like, definitely do that. Simon seems really passive. It doesn't seem like he'll flip on you. They don't have a real idol. But, like, what if Harry found the idol earlier? Like, they don't know who has or doesn't have an idol. They don't have the numbers to split votes. I think you have to be very certain. They'd only just swapped. The dynamics might have been a little vague, haven't been able to feel it out yet. It's the kind of thing that looks so obvious to us because it looks like it's going to go well. But at the same time, when I spoke to Sam, she was like, we considered throwing the challenge. And I was like, that makes complete sense. It's even more sensical for them with their allies on the other side, not in a good spot. With a 7-2, the actual capacity to split the votes, and look how it goes for Sam. And even if they didn't break up, then, you know, there were two idols. So you don't know everything. And we look at it and we have a bird's eye view. So we're looking at it like they should. And how scary must that be? Plus, you don't know how many tribal councils there will be before a swap or a merge. You know, are you going to keep throwing and get rid of all of them and then have to eat your own? Like, at that point, you'll probably just be losing challenges because you'll be so down in the numbers. So I don't begrudge them not throwing it, even though it seems to make sense to us.
You know what's going to be great about Harry's family visit is that they're going to come out and they're going to say, like, Harry's going to be like, how was Oscar? And they're going to think it means, like, how were the Oscars? And they're going to be like, oh, you know, Rami Malek won for Bohemian Rhapsody. Like, because, I mean, if you think about it, this was filmed, like, around the time of the Oscars, right? So you sort of picked the perfect name to get away with.
Yeah, I feel like you have to tell your Thunder D equivalent that this is something that you're planning on doing beforehand, just in case they do come out to visit you on the island.
Well, hopefully it's his girlfriend, because then I'm not entirely sure. And that'd be interesting to see how much she commits to that narrative.
Oh, my God. This, now I'm so invested in Harry's storyline. So from a TV perspective, it really was good. And just a broad final question. Randy Newport asks, is the Australian public buying into the hype of this season as much as I am? And like, I love it. And I think the ratings have been pretty good. The block has now started, which is a really hard thing for us to go against. I think the ratings have definitely been, you know, commendable. Definitely on Twitter, I think there seems to be a lot of love for it. I don't really go into the other social media. I mean, I really hope that people are loving it because it's such a good season. And 2017 was great and it didn't get good ratings and I still don't understand.
The only thing is, so who would you say was the most famous person on the Champions Tribe? Was it E.T.?
I didn't even know who E.T. was. I mean, Janine, maybe? Simon Black? It really depends what kind of, you know, interest you have outside of the show.
Yeah. Because I really do wonder if part of the ratings buoy from last season was the fact that you had people like Matt Rogers and Brian Lake and Shane Gould stay in for such a long time. You know, maybe one of the unfortunate side effects of getting rid of so many of these notable people so early on is there people are like, well, I came to see E.T. and Simon Black. I didn't come to see David. Who's David?
Are people watching because of that? Like, are there, you know, Stanbury's? I mean, besides Liana, I don't know if anyone's watching for Steve Bradbury or Nova Paris or Susie Maroney. Like, I don't, or E.T. even. I mean, surely, is that something people do? You're going to watch this whole show just to kind of see E.T. get like 15 confessionals? Surely not.
I don't know. I would not be surprised. And maybe, you know, you have someone like Pia holding it down as the renowned actress. But I really hope that this stays up because I love Australian Survivor. I think this is a really great season. They built on the formula from the first season and improved upon it. I love the fact that we got a swap in episode 7 instead of like what episode 11 or 12 in last season, which felt like it took forever. It was, you know, the kid from The Simpsons, stop, the contenders are already dead. So I was happy to see this mixed up, because you could tell that these people were willing to flip and willing to make things happen. And now that it's happened so quickly, this game is just super kinetic. There are bits of time to rest, like you said, but I have been supremely enjoying this season. I mean, the summer is hot for International Survivor between this and South Africa. So it's a perfect, you know, way to keep the fire stoked until we move into Survivor 39 in the fall. I have been supremely enjoying it, and I've been really enjoying listening to you, you know, captain the ship as well. It's been really nice to hear you take the lead on all this, Shannon. Your love for Survivor ekes through each and everything you do, and this is no different.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I mean, I'm pumped up to be doing it, and I'm super pumped up that it's like such a good season. I mean, I got very lucky with International Survivor.
It's it. I mean, listen, it's, I think, you know, they're getting a good idea as to what they want to do, and the U.S. does what they want to do, and they have their own pros and cons as well. So it's always interesting to also observe, you know, the differences between them. I know that we got a question on Twitter about a week or so ago as to like South Africa or Australia, which one's better. And I know I'm sort of
playing
fancy. I'm not
going to choose between my fake children.
but they're different in so many ways, you know, whereas I feel like Survivor South Africa maybe does a better job in terms of editing and characterization. This does Australian Survivor does a better job with, you know, building big TV moments and big challenge moments. So honestly, it's all good Survivor. When it depends on, you know, you, whatever you enjoy about Survivor more is probably going to determine which franchise you enjoy more.
Yeah. Well, we got so lucky, Mike. What is the hashtag for this podcast for the people who made it to the end? Hashtag Whale Balls is, I don't want this to become my brand, and I don't even know why it is, but I also like hashtag double edge visor. Brilliant.
Double edge visor is a good one. We have hashtag Survivor Stunt Double, hashtag Goober Fan as well as a choice.
also good. I think let's go hashtag double edge visor. It's just, yeah, it's perfect for the unfortunate run we saw for Andy this week that JLP keeps harping on about.
Yeah. And listen, I think that, you know, I'm hoping that this goober is able to climb his way back up. He's definitively on the bottom of his tribe at this point with a tribe that is consistently losing.
Yeah.
Maybe he's going to be able to worm his way in to David and Luke to keep him around over someone. Well, actually, I would say he's not on the bottom of the bottom because Hannah was left out of the vote. So it seems like she might be the next to go. Maybe she'll get a confessional along the way while she does it.
But there's also a fake idol that is going to come up. So we'll see.
Which I am so excited about. Like you said, this has been one of the best recurring storylines I can remember in recent Survivor memory. And I just love that we're getting another episode in its saga, especially if Daisy has now been informed that the big tight alliance that she's made, betrayed one of her closest allies back in the Contenders. That's going to lead to a really interesting choice on her part. So sure to be a lot of great stuff from Australian Survivor. We're a third of the way through the season, but we are far from done.
Yeah, well, Mike, you know, what do you have going on besides watching all these International Survivor? I know that you're also podcasting about a lot of other stuff.
So there's this show called Survivor South Africa where my co-host
and I... I was about to plug that. Don't take my one thing. You have like 10 things.
All right, we'll put a pin in that. So I am covering Big Brother for Parade Magazine. I'm doing exit press for that every week. If you were intrigued by the Chill Town comparisons with Luke and David, definitely be sure to check that out. I'll also be getting together with Liana Boris to do some coverage on the RHAPBBB&B. Josh Wiggler and I are doing, we did some coverage of Stranger Things Season 3. Now we're doing a bunch of Stranger Things adjacent podcasts. Most recently, we just recorded a recap of The Neverending Story, which is such a weird movie and such a weird conversation. We had so much fun. We're just going to keep doing a bunch of really interesting projects as we segue, go down the bunker, down the hatch into what's to come with a fun new project next month. And, you know, I was speaking about U.S. Survivor. We are encroaching weeks away on when Survivor 39, Island of the Idols, is going to be coming back to our screens. I was very fortunate enough to be, like these champions and contenders, out in Fiji last March to check out the first few days of the season. I have a slew of really fun preseason content that I am very excited to drop on you all. I've been working through it all, and I'm so, so excited for you all to meet this cast. It's going to be a really fun group, and I think it's going to be a really fun season as well. And you can catch up on all that and all the other random musings I have at @AMikeGloomType on Twitter and Instagram.
So Survivor South Africa is what we are covering every week. Last week, we live taste tested Biostrath. People are calling that they're calling it something. It was something that we did. I don't know. Where are we falling on that?
I also mentioned, so we were, from what the tastes we were describing, it seems like a lot of people said, okay, sounds like what you were trying, it was akin to Vegemite. And I know that one of the rewards at the cafe this week, Oliver's Cafe, not Oscar's Cafe, were Cheesy Mite Scrolls, which apparently are like pastries with Vegemite in them. So I would say I might throw that reward challenge if those Cheesy Mite Scrolls are getting anywhere near any of those other delicious pastries, because I am hard pressed to stay away from anything involving Vegemite for maybe the rest of my life based on that taste test.
Yeah, I mean, I'd never heard of Cheesy Mite Scrolls before. See, I'm like, I'm not South African. I'm not Australian. Who am I? Anyway, the crisis of faith that I continue to go through. But next week, we have the great Jean-Michel on the podcast. It's really fun. If you guys aren't watching enough Survivor already, you know, let me know. Slide into my DMs. We can all watch Survivor South Africa together. Follow along with our content. You can follow me at Shannon Gates for all of that stuff, all of the cheesy chats, all of the question threads, all of my musings about pretty much this week, just Harry's fake baby. That was like the entirety of my tweets for one whole night. But, you know, follow me there. I would also love if you guys would subscribe to the International Survivor Wrap-Ups feed, which is where all the South Africa and Australia podcasts are. And if you could be so kind, if you've gotten over 2 hours into this podcast with X interviews still to come, if you could rate us 5 stars, if you could, you know, give us kind reviews, we are not asking for the negative reviews, but I mean, I guess it's a free country. But if you could give us some reviews and some star ratings and help people find the show, that would be amazing. And next week,
support your goober fans, people. Come
yes,
on.
Yes, definitely. Next week on the Survivor AU podcast, I have the great Jackie Glazier, champion in her own right, a poker player, a Rubik's Cube champion, and I'm really excited to get her thoughts on the season.
Yes, you finally have expended your streak of American shit.
Well,
you
are going actually not. I have some other people planned for us.
You're going to Australia. I'm very excited to hear from Jackie. You know, especially in this post-swap era, this was a time where, let's remember, even though I did say that Tegan got screwed over by the swap, they did get rid of Jackie. over her. So I'm sure she has some opinions about, you know, the Sam boot. And I'm assuming, you know, the choices that some of those people on the new Champions tribe have made. And I'm very excited to listen to her. She was a really fun character.
And as far as I'm aware, it's another 3 episodes. So glad you guys are all keeping up. At least it's good. You know what? It would suck if it was bad, but at least it's good. So we have nothing to complain about. But Mike, thank you so much for coming on and talking. I talked to you too much. Like, I'm sure you're completely sick of me, but I really appreciate getting all your thoughts into Australian Survivor. And thank you for coming on.
Of course, it was my pleasure. Like I said, you've been doing an incredible job with this podcast so far. I am in love with this season. I cannot wait to see where it goes from here. And look, you know, we got a little bit of a deviation from our usual Survivor South Africa talk. So I'm happy to get back home after having a nice little away trip to talk about another Survivor franchise for a hot second.
Yeah, it's been fun. But now I am going to throw it to my exit interviews with E.T., with Sam, not a body double, with the actual Sam, as far as I'm aware, and then with Sarah. So I hope you guys enjoy that. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks to Scott St. Pierre behind the scenes. Thanks again to you, Mike. And I will now throw it to those exit interviews. Bye.
Hello.
Hi, E.T. Thank you so much for coming on to Rob Has a Podcast. Really sorry to see you go last night, but I think the fact that everyone was so emotionally affected definitely shows, you know, how much you were loved out there and your good character, which is always really commendable.
Yeah, it's sort of, you know, it's a funny one, really. I built up quite nice relationships with everybody, but I was still on the wrong side of the alliance. So it makes it really hard for everyone when you keep losing those immunity challenges.
Yeah, well, you said in your final words that you kind of wish maybe that you had a different alliance than the Sporty Seven. Who do you think you would have aligned with had you had more time to work it out?
Yeah, I think straight away I sort of had a connection with Luke Tokey. So, you know, and Luke had been there and done that before. So, you know, there was, you know, we'd already got that alliance up so quick that, you know, when Luke came and approached me, I sort of went, oh, gosh, we've already got the Seven. You know, what do I do here? So I sort of put it off. But 3 days later, we'd already lost Abby and Roscoe and, you know, had gone across and voted against the person that we wanted to keep in. So it really was, it was a real quick change of the guard. And then we were on the wrong side of the numbers.
Yeah, well, I mean, you also said in your final words, go Luke, which I think surprised a lot of the audience because we really didn't get to see your personal relationship with him on the screen.
Yeah, the hardest part is that you probably only see a tenth of what actually happens out there. Some of the challenges that I was involved in, you know, I was in some of them, I was sort of up against Andy in one. Actually, the first challenge probably went 15 to 20 minutes. And you only see probably, you know, 2 minutes on television. So you can kind of couldn't see why we were so exhausted. But that was the reason why, you know, we'd been going on forever. And I guess that's the good and the bad with the show. They've got so much footage to you know, use, and they a lot of it ends up on the cutting room floor, so you probably didn't see, you know, the connections building with many of us. And you know, that's why it made it probably even a little bit more surprising at the end that everyone was so emotional.
Believe me, it looked exhausting to me, even the little bit that we saw, so don't worry about that. No. But yeah, you talk about the emotions, and definitely saw a lot of that from Abby. So can you talk me through your relationship with her? Because I think even pre-season, I was like, this girl's a footy girl. She loves fishing as well, I knew. So I feel like that was a really ingrained connection there.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, the funny thing is with the Champions team, you've often bumped into them along the way. And so, you know, I'd met Stephen Bradbury before and Nova Peris. I'd done an awards thing with her before. So many of them that you sort of had a relationship with. Only a small one, but I'd actually met Abby at a function that I had to speak at one time. And Abby was there and we had a good chat. And, you know, at that stage, I didn't really know too much about Abby. And, you know, then the next minute she's on my Champions team and I'm sort of talking to her and she goes, oh, yeah, you came and did this talk. And then I remembered her and we had so much in common because she loves the Northern Territory, loves all the fishing, and obviously played AFL at a high level. And so sport was something that connected us as well. And, you know, I think she, we just sort of got a nice little bond happening straight away. And it was the same with sort of everybody. I developed some nice relationships. And I guess afterwards you're thinking, okay, after this all is over and the game finishes, you still want to be on good terms and be able to talk to these people. So, you know, it's a little bit of a tricky situation for the Champions.
Yeah, and obviously Abby betrayed you guys, and we saw most of that emotionally on the screen from Nova and Steven, but how did you react to that betrayal?
Well, I was very disappointed, of course. It was hard for me to, you're in the game of Survivor, so you know that these things are going to happen, but because it happened so quick and, it really did play a big, with a big dent in our side. And I know that Nova and Stephen were very upset about it. And I was upset, but I thought, well, you know, if I start to betray this person who's going to be blowing up about everything, I'm going to be off before I know it. So, you know, my game plan there was to, you know, basically just try to say, well, you know, talk to Abby about it. Say that, you know, it was all okay and, you know, hopefully, you know, she told me that, you know, there certainly isn't an alliance on the other side and that she'd be happy to jump back on with us for the next vote. But, you know, it all, David behind the scenes was doing a real number. I think he played the girls pretty well and, you know, he's become a real, a real thorn in the side of pretty much, all of the other contestants.
Yeah, well, we saw David's name come up in the last two episodes. Do you feel, being part of those plans, that he was ever, you know, especially two episodes ago, do you think he was ever a realistic name to come up, or was that just kind of for the show?
Yeah, I didn't think that he'd get voted out. You know, when you're actually in there, in the situation I was in, I was sort of looking at it and I was thinking, you know, these guys are super strong. I just couldn't see that there were these cracks starting to form. And even though David was acting like a bit of a goat, you know, in some of the situations, you know, trying to make out he was the kingpin and, you know, and really arrogant, I didn't see that the girls were sort of over, over him at that stage, and that they were still sort of happy to stay with that six because it meant they were going to be moving forward regardless. But in retrospect, looking back, and you know, you could see the cracks starting to open up a little bit. And you know, I knew that he was playing another game inside the game, but I didn't realize that, you know, he was really playing those girls along so well, and he was going over the top. You know, there's no way in the world that I could have built a relationship the way that he was building with those girls at that stage. And you know, he, once he got that idol, he thought he was king of the world.
Yeah, well, we definitely are seeing that. And, you know, you proved very key in both challenges last night, a lot of strength-based challenges, which you were extremely helpful in. Why do you think that you were targeted before Simon, your ally, who obviously was, you know, maybe another plan?
Yeah, I guess there's a number of different things there. I suppose Simon was very quiet and probably wasn't as upfront as I was early in the piece where, Stephen had sort of dumped a lot of the responsibility onto me in the early stages, and he wasn't the one going around talking to everybody and trying to get everybody on side, and he was leaving that to me, which sort of puts you more in a vulnerable position. And I knew that we had to, you know, communicate to everybody and get the messages across. It just didn't sort of pan out that way for me. I thought Stephen was going to do a lot more of that. He didn't, but you know, that put a lot more pressure on me as we were sort of, as the game unfolded, I guess, you know, because I was trying to vote out Janine at one stage, you know, the girls sort of probably looked upon me as the one more so than Simon was the one there. And so Simon, I guess, got a few more brownie points up than me. And it was a bit of a flip of the coin in the end.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say that I was impressed because I know that a lot of the leadership responsibilities were given to you, which is not usually great, but look how many of the 47 went before you. So how do you think that you managed that leadership role to not be an immediate target when you lost numbers?
I think it was, basically just trying to keep my cool and, the whole way through it, it was, you know, you're in a pressure situation. And what I was thinking was that, you know, at some stage we're going to start winning these immunity challenges, and you kind of rely on your physical strength. And we were going so close in all of them, and we're winning the reward challenges one day, and the next day we'd lose the immunities. And I'm just shaking my head. And we lost four in a row. And I think we only won the one, and it was sort of crazy. You know, I just couldn't believe this was happening. And I thought the tide had turned, and you know, every time I went into a challenge, I put every single drop of energy into it, but somebody would muck it up. And I just, you know, couldn't believe that. And I had to keep my mouth shut. I really couldn't go and, you know, scream and shout about it, which I probably in normal life would have. But in that environment, if you start yelling and screaming and getting a bit too carried away, you put yourself in the situation, which unfortunately Stephen did. And, you know, you just get voted out.
Yeah, just one last person I wanted to ask about was Ross, because he's someone obviously you worked with, and then he also betrayed you, but you kind of flirted with the idea of working with him again. So what kind of relationship did you have with him?
Well, Ross is one of those characters. You just, you know, he was just so loose. You just did not know where he was going. I don't think he knew where he was going. And so, you know, he was one of those guys that he was always a swing vote, and you never knew whether you had him on your side or not. Even at the start, you know, like we all agreed, you know, we everyone was real keen on this seven athletes, and he was all keen as well. But as soon as you start to meet other people and you get in relationships, and you start to chat about different things, and common interests sort of bind you together, and now next minute you've got to vote this person off, it does change everything. And I think he was probably one of those guys that it was so easy, you know, when Luke and David decided that they needed to really infiltrate our camp and get to across, they knew that there's no way they were getting me across, no way they were getting Nova across, or Stephen, or Susie. So there were these five who were, you know, pretty much going to be loyal to each other, and the two which weren't is going to be Abby, where you know, basically David did the emotional sort of aspect there, and, you know, become real pally and best buddies. And, you know, it sort of, I don't know, to me, got out of hand a little bit. I couldn't have gone down that path at all, but David was able to. And then on the other hand, you had, you know, big Lukey. He said, right, I'm going to target Roscoe. And, you know, he's a real playful guy, so I'll try to, you know. So they were basically played pretty well by those two guys, and they were able to, you know, form that alliance from there, which has seen them go on.
Yeah, such a shame. But, you know, as I said, great to see you get as far as you did. Really awesome to see you on the show and to see those real, genuine, emotional connections that you made. So thank you so much for coming on to talk about your game with us.
Yeah, great. Thanks very much, and good to talk to you too.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Hello.
Hi, Sam. Thank you so much for coming on to Rob Has a Podcast. Obviously, a shocking vote last night, so we really appreciate getting your perspective on your game.
No, that's completely fine.
Well, I want to just jump back to the Contenders Beach if I can, because we really didn't get to see a lot of the dynamics there, obviously. So who did you consider yourself really close with in that tribe?
Yes, I had a little sneaky alliance with Harry, Andy, Casey, and myself. We nicknamed ourselves the Cash Alliance, which was the beginning letter of each of our names. So we actually had an alliance the whole time. We just never got to put it into play because we weren't going to tribal.
Yeah, I could see you looked obviously really close with Andy that we saw last night. And then kind of on the opposite side, who do you feel would have been going to tribal if that tribe had ever gone back? Like, were there some main targets out there?
Oh, there are a lot of names being thrown out there. Like Baden was one for sure. Eden Sarah at some points. Even Daisy's name was being thrown out there.
Yeah, because obviously this relationship with Daisy does become quite important. Why was Daisy's name the one being thrown out on the Contenders Beach?
Look, she's quite loud and quite opinionated, and I think it kind of rubbed people the wrong way. And a few people just didn't find her that trustworthy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, obviously, Davey and John here are the two that flipped. What about your personal relationship with each of them? Obviously, her name was out there, but did you have much of a personal connection with them?
Yeah, look, John's a legend. He's great. I didn't really have much of an opinion of John. But yeah, more like Daisy. In the beginning, Daisy and I clicked really well. And throughout the competition, she kind of attached herself to Sean. And Sean's a really strong player. So yeah, I guess she was a bit of a threat.
Right, definitely. So did you ever think that they would flip once you had swapped to the other tribe?
No, I mean, well, not at least initially. Like, you've got to remember, there's so much that isn't shown. And because we weren't going to tribal for, like, 9 days, we had talked about our strategy with what we would do with the tribes were to swap and different scenarios that we could play out if, you know, depending on who had the majority and who had the minority. We were talking about, you know, throwing challenges just so we could get more contenders to the finish line if it came to merge. So, yeah, I just didn't think anybody was going to flip that early on.
Yeah, I mean, it obviously didn't seem like you were throwing that challenge at all last night. At what point do you think you would have implemented that? Because the contenders really seem to be, you know, having a problem on the other side.
We even talked about at the initial last night's challenge. Andy, myself, and Daisy were kind of looking at each other like, "Do we just throw this?" Because we had 7 OG contenders over on the Champion Beach, but it's something that we just didn't want to do.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, this is why it can get very dangerous to do that, because I could see why you would feel really safe and then have it be a problem. And you say Baden obviously was on the bottom, and he obviously flipped as well. What about your personal relationship with him?
No, Baden was lovely. I can't say it was much of a personal relationship, but, you know, he slowly did prove himself. He was good with some puzzle challenges throughout the game.
Yeah, and then was there ever any inkling from you to work with Luke and David against someone like a Daisy if her name had been out there before?
Look, I'd only been on the beach not even 24 hours, so it's pretty hard to form those strong kind of bonds with people. I mean, I really did like Luke early on, and I was, you know, if anything, I wanted to keep Luke on the beach. But, you know, everything in hindsight, I wish I could go back and change it.
Yeah, I mean, we did see some sort of, like, conflict with David. Not really conflict, but he obviously wanted to target you. So what do you think that came from?
I don't think he was really just trying to target me. I think he was just trying to get himself out of hot water. Like, he did say that I had a smug look on my face, which I thought was, you know, the pot calling the kettle black, considering he's had a smug look on his face for the past 6 episodes.
Yeah, and then obviously they target you over Andy. So why do you think that they went for you over, obviously, Andy as well, who was a potential target?
Yeah, look, that's a question that you would have to ask them. I never really got the privilege to ask them. But like I said, I guess you don't see everything that happens on the show. And behind the scenes, there were a lot of, you know, little alliances and names being thrown out there the whole time. So I guess, you know, Daisy just got a little bit paranoid about me and she wanted me out.
Yeah, and you say obviously you were aligned with Andy from the get-go, which, you know, obviously had an alliance with him. What made you guys so close, besides obviously your names fitting into this perfect cash alliance?
Yeah, so when there was like the 12 contenders on the beach, we kind of worked out that there was a bottom 4 and a top 4, and Harry, Casey, Andy and myself were kind of there sitting in the middle, so that's why we formed our own little secret alliance.
Right, yeah, definitely. And so it seems like people from the bottom and the top then on contenders were targets, because you were saying someone like Daisy's more at the top and someone like Baden and Sarah at the bottom, so you kind of wanted to sit in the middle there and not be on the extremes of either side.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely right.
Yeah, and then, so how did you get involved with Survivor? Because I know you've been on reality TV before.
Yeah, I guess it's just one of those bucket list items. I think about 8 years ago, I did The Amazing Race, and I was lucky enough to come second. Survivor has always been, you know, on the cards. And finally, timing was right, sent in my audition video, and, yeah, I got selected. So, yeah, it's kind of cool to be that first Aussie that can say that they've done both Amazing Race and Survivor.
Yeah, if they ever bring back Big Brother, maybe you could be the first to do the trifecta. But,
look, I think I'm going to hang up my reality TV boots for a little while.
Well, how did it compare to your experience on The Amazing Race, which is obviously very different, but in some ways, you know, is that reality TV similarity?
Yeah, look, everybody thinks they're kind of similar, but they absolutely aren't. They're on different ends of the spectrum. Amazing Race is like hard and fast, and Survivor's quite slow and torturous. So I thought maybe having that experience was going to help me, but I found that it didn't really.
Yeah, and then so obviously something that is kind of like the elephant in the room, and I think Twitter was really angry about, was just like how uneven and unfair your edit was to not get a concessional. That's brutal. And how do you feel about that? Because Twitter is very angry, I can assure you.
Yeah, no, I've been told. I don't have Twitter, but, yeah, a few people have reached out and told me that. Look, yeah, I mean, they just wanted to focus on this bloody idol and fake idol. There's so much that you don't get to see, unfortunately. So many great challenges that you don't see. So, yeah, I guess I feel slightly ripped off, but, you know, I know what happened and the other players out there know what happened, and I guess that's what's important to me.
Yeah, I just think that, you know, it's obviously hard for the viewers as well, because, you know, you come in there and it's such a huge vote and it kind of loses a bit of that emotional weight. So I guess we just really wish we could have seen more of your story played out to us.
Yeah, I think for last night's vote, you just need a little more context. People are a little bit confused how my name got brought into the mix. So if you had seen a little bit more, it would have made a little bit more sense.
Yeah, because obviously the contenders' dynamics in general are really confusing to us, and we don't really understand how this crack could happen so soon. I mean, you say that you came in with a plan, and how long? So there was this 24 hours after the swap that the tribal council happened.
Yeah, correct. It happened the next day.
Right. So, yeah, for that must have been, like, you know, dynamics that were kind of combustible for it to break up so quickly. And we obviously see that Andy talks about the idol. So do you think that that was, like, a key factor in this, in the flip, obviously?
I think, like, I honestly do think Daisy was going to stick with contenders. I really do. I didn't know. I thought she was aware that Andy was going to tell us about this idol. And Andy wasn't telling us about Sean's idol for shits and giggles. He was telling us this more to make us believe that there was an idol between Dave and Luke. So he just wanted to kind of put some weight behind that. So, because we were like, how do you know that he has an idol? And he needed to explain the story about the switch of the idols. So he wasn't just trying to rat Sean out. He was just trying to put some weight behind the story.
Yeah. And then obviously, you know, he has the coin toss and he's talking at tribal council. And, you know, as someone who was his ally and who kind of paid for that, no pun intended with the coin, but as someone who was connected to him, do you feel that he was kind of overplaying there? And if you'd kind of kept it straight, maybe Daisy and John and Baden would have stuck with you guys?
Actually, no. Like, I thought his plan, if you actually think about it, it was really smart. If Daisy hadn't have flipped, even if I still got out, both of the boys most likely would have played their idols.
Yeah.
Their idols. So, and if they put down my name, then I probably would have got majority of the votes anyway. So I would have gone out, but you would have flushed two idols in the meantime. So, look, and that was according to his plan. If you flip the coin, nobody was going to know the answer. Neither of those boys would have known who was going to be up, and that was the plan.
Right. But yeah, as you said, two idols were coming for you anyway, unless, you know, you could really fool them. So it was a hard, hard tribal council for sure. Very unfortunate place to be in a swap.
Yeah, look, it sucks, but that's the nature of the game, unfortunately. I've always said I'd rather be epically blindsided than sit there and know that my name was going to be called.
Yeah, it was definitely epic, definitely a huge vote. So thank you so much for coming on to share some of your game. I know our listeners really wanted to know more where you sat in the tribe dynamic, so thank you for that.
Yeah, no worries. Cheers. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Hello.
Hi, Sarah. Great to talk to you. Thank you for coming on to Rob Has a Podcast. It was great to see your story on the TV. I think the whole country agrees. It was really inspiring. So it's great to talk to you.
Oh, thank you very much, Evan.
Well, I want to talk about all that stuff as well, but just to get into a bit of the dynamics on the Contenders tribe, because we really didn't get to see enough of it. So when you were on Contenders Beach, who did you consider your closest allies?
Oh, look, I guess early on it was Lauren until she got sent home, Hannah and Sammy, although eventually I was in an alliance just with Maddie and myself. But the tribe swap came and that all fell through. So, yeah, they're my closest peeps.
Right. So then obviously if you were so close to Laura, was there anything that could be done there, do you think, to kind of save her, or was it a lost cause?
Oh, look, at the end of the day, it was first boot, and I was just glad that it wasn't me going home, to be honest. I was vulnerable being the eldest. So I didn't want her to go, and I didn't want Baden to go either, really, because he was the Adelaide guy, the other South Australian there. So at the end of the day, as long as it wasn't me, unfortunately, looking back on it now, losing her was a number down for us. So, because Baden went the other way. Yeah, easy in hindsight, though, isn't it?
Right. So when you say for us, like, how did you see the overall dynamics of who was on what side?
Look, there was a very clear sort of division evolving from early on with Daisy and Sean has been shown. And then there was Sammy, Harry as well on the other side. And then there were the people sort of in the middle that the sort of Baden ended up with Daisy and Sean as well as John. And Hannah and myself were more aligned with Harry and Sammy. So, yeah, unfortunately, it's just the stronger sort of were calling the shots in the end.
And I know it can be so hard to say, but if you guys had gone back to a tribal council, do you have an inkling of who would have gone home before the swap?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. At the bottom of the pile, so to speak, was probably myself and Hannah. Probably more so her, because they were, sort of valued my strengths. But yeah, we were sort of at the bottom of the heap.
Right. And then obviously you get to the swap. Was there ever any realistic possibility that you would have worked with Luke and David? Because I know there's been some kind of whisperings, you know, online and stuff that they were kind of, you know, trying to talk to you and Hannah about working with them.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Well, some of that, well, it wasn't shown, but I think what was shown was Luke has approached, you know how Luke was approaching us individually. I sort of said, look, we've got this idea. And it was the same idea as Daisy. It was getting them on board with us to get our numbers up, to get them with us, to get her out. But at the end of the day, Sammy at the well, she said to us, what's the point of getting rid of a contender at this point? It's not going to benefit my game. And that night she went home. So, yeah, we weren't brave enough. We weren't decisive enough when we needed to be, unfortunately. And Daisy, kudos to her. She made the move and she got them on board.
I keep hearing Daisy's name. Obviously, she's the person you target after this vote, and you just said there that she might have been a target. So what was it about Daisy and maybe your relationship with her that made sure she was always kind of the name being brought up?
Oh, look, Daisy took down Sammy. And look, she's calling the shots very cleverly. And she was a smart player. She was strong. She was tough. She sort of controlled the food situation. Yeah, and we knew that was only a matter of time before it was going to swing around to us, especially after Sammy went. Yeah, I mean, it was probably all too late by then. But, yeah, she was a strong player, and had the merge not happened so soon, I think there was probably a chance that she would have been targeted by us. But who knows? Casey and Andy, on the other hand, were roving around a bit, and they were hard to pinpoint at the time who they were aligned to. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm definitely interested in your relationship with Andy, kind of as it pertains to the entire game and that last day, because it seemed like you guys were quite close, and then it kind of obviously derailed at the end.
Oh, girl. He was close with everyone. He was Uncle Andy. He was smiling and charming and over the top and passionate. I don't think any of us really suspected he was playing as hard as he was. Clever guy. But, yeah, we were both the older team tribe members, but at the end of the day, we didn't have a huge amount of time that we spent talking in those early days. It was only in those last couple of days that we sort of chat, and yeah, he's obviously was a snake and I didn't see it, so
yeah,
he got me.
And then you've spoken about your relationship with Baden and how, you know, there was a connection there. And then he's obviously one of the people to flip on your group with Sammy. Was that kind of crushing from a personal perspective if you'd had the relationship, or was it kind of far gone at that point?
Oh, look, it wasn't crushing, but in retrospect, I wish that I'd targeted him more closely with my conversations, because I would have seen straight through him. We kind of clicked, and he's just around the corner from me. We had a good relationship, and I reckon he would have had a real difficult time lying to my face. He would have gone bright red, and I would have seen straight through him. So had I worked on Baden harder at the time, it could have ended differently. But as I say, retrospect is easy. So, yeah, what do you do?
Yeah.
Damn him.
Obviously, you know, you had a lifeline kind of with David in that last vote, and he's saying maybe they'll vote for Andy. Did you think that plan was going to come together, or was it a blindside, or did you think you were going home?
No, I thought I was going home. It wasn't a complete blindside. I thought, if I'm going to go down, I'm going to go down fighting, and I'm going to call Andy out for everything, for flip-flopping and playing different sides of the fence like he did. But, you know, I knew I was going, basically. I tried to change a mind or two, but, yeah, they'd made their decision and they stuck to it.
Yeah, really hard situation, obviously, being in that spot. To take it back to kind of the stuff with, you know, the challenges and things that obviously really, I think, as I said, really spoke to Australia in general. So that challenge where you had to, you know, jump off the platform and Casey immediately volunteered, obviously, not to do it. Was there any conversation around that even before at camp? Like, how did you see that whole situation playing out?
Oh, my goodness. It was a conversation two nights before, and we were having a chat about how we'd seen Monica struggle last year with that exact challenge. And she was like, oh, no, God, I'd hate that, Rara. And I did too. I said, oh, yeah, not me at all. I wouldn't want to do it either. So we both agreed that we didn't want to do it, and the thought of it terrified us. But I didn't know how I was going to react up there. You know, I thought the adrenaline could get me through. I certainly didn't think some primitive part of my brain was going to go, Sarah, last time you did this, you almost died. So she felt terrible. And I certainly felt terrible, but at the end of the day, you know, I thought I could do it and I just epically failed.
No, I mean, I definitely wouldn't consider that a failure. And I think the way that your tri-mates reacted showed that some things are a lot more important and a lot more inspiring than hot chocolate and marshmallows are. But obviously we've seen the challenge last night. I mean, you go into the chamber, which would be, I think, quite traumatic for anyone. So as I said, just amazing to watch, but kind of how did you take that experience going from, you know, the jumping challenge into this?
Well, I thought, God, if I back out, I'm really showing my weakness. No one was actually wanting to do it, particularly. Baden was terrified. So I put my hand up, said, okay, I'll do it. I can hold my breath. I've done it before. But yeah, I've gotten in the box and there was this massive jungle spider in there, which wasn't so nice. So I've just jumped straight back out and said, can you get the spider out, please?
I can deal with the water, not
the spider. Not dealing with both. And I think that was certainly more emotionally challenging than the tower. The tower was sort of pure fear, and whatever was going on was kind of on a subconscious level. But that holding my breath and having the water trickle down the back of the nose before you hold your breath, that first bit of water goes in and then you block yourself off. That was challenging.
Yeah, and obviously we see, you know, Luke say how your kids will be proud and you're talking about your family. What's it been like for them watching you go through those experiences on the TV show?
Oh, they've loved it. My daughter sort of didn't want to watch here and there because she was just completely scared that I was just going to embarrass herself. Like, yeah, she was going to cop it at school for her mum failing at God knows what. But no, they loved it. And my son sort of just sits there in awe. And now he's kind of expecting to see me on TV every night. So I'm not sure what's going to happen. But yeah, it's fun.
Yeah. And so I've been waiting to get a contender on the line so I can ask this question. Did Harry tell you that he had a baby? Like, I need to know, was he telling the contenders that he had a 3-year-old child?
Absolutely.
Oh, yep. My God.
Why on earth? And I've gotten out and found out that he's like, how is that going to benefit your game? You know, I was the only mum in the contender tribe and Sean was the only other parent.
Yeah.
And it was like, how does this benefit you by telling me this? Like, it's just absurd. And I've remembered having chats looking up at the stars about our kids and screen time and oh my goodness, Harry.
Did he seem informed as a parent? Like, were you like, this guy seems ill-equipped to be a parent?
We stuck to superficial stuff. And I sort of remember thinking, you seem a little bit shady to be a parent, but, you know, there's all different types. But Casey worked it out. Casey is a teacher, and I think she asked him a couple of developmental type questions of a 3-year-old, and he said something along the lines of, yeah, he only says a few words or something like that. He had no clue, and she thought to herself, yeah, nah, that's a lie.
Okay, that's amazing to find out. I don't know, I wish we could have seen more of that because I still don't understand it, but thank you for letting us know.
Okay.
I'd love to know what your experience with Survivor is, like, were you a fan before you came on?
I was, especially in the early days, back in the early US seasons, where it wasn't so much based on the strategy. My husband and I used to really enjoy watching people basically get dehydrated and really suffer. That survival aspect was more pivotal to the game, but it has evolved and we still enjoy it. I wouldn't call us super fans, but we understand it and we love it.
Well, that's great. And as I said, I think you were a great, you know, character for the show, and a lot of the stuff that you were doing with your story, it goes, you know, beyond Survivor. As you say, you're a survivor, but it shouldn't even be in the same sentence for what we're watching, you know, on a beach in Fiji. So thank you for sharing that story with us, and thank you for coming on the podcast to talk with us.
You're welcome, Shannon. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay, everybody, there you have it. Week 3 of Australian Survivor is in the books, 8 episodes down in 2 weeks. I don't know how we did it, but we did. We did it together. Thank you guys so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the recap with Mike Bloom. I had so much fun doing that. I hope you enjoyed the 3 exit interviews this week. A lot of fun personalities on the season. And just a reminder, you can catch me on ABC's Radio National Stop Everything, 10 a.m. or around 10:30. I'll come on Sydney time on Friday. That's this Friday, August 9, talking about this podcast, talking about Survivor in general, and just having a really great conversation about where the show is at. So I hope that you guys will check it out. So many places you can listen to it, you know, the ABC listening app, radio.abc.net.au, your local radio national frequency, which you can find online if you're in Australia. So check it out there, and then it will be released as a podcast, the Stop Everything podcast afterwards. So I hope you guys will check that out. Thank you again for listening. I hope that you had a great time, and I will see you next week with Jackie. Bye.